Public Committee on House Water and Environment. And I will open.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, we will open on the House now. We don't have. Did
you end this now?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair?
That's approved.
Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3606.
Captain Cruz moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3606. Those of the opinion that the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3606 will vote aye, and those opposed, no. And we don't have to have discussion on this matter, do we? Okay. Mr. Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Motion carried. The rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair. I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3606 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3606 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now we are open for discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
We need to send it to the right place.
Well, what happened, I think after we had heard the bill and we moved on it, we had a preliminary revenue and fiscal, and it didn't look at, like there was anything that was going to develop. And it did afterwards, and then at that point in time, I was notified by the chair of revenue and the speaker, and we said, well, let's just take it back and send it back over to revenue where we'll argue this out. There is, seems to be in language of a loophole that shows that the program could be expanded, and that's the problem. If it can be expanded, then there's a further revenue report or consideration. So we're going to move over there and take care of it at that point in time.
Mr. Chair.
That's in much.
Just clarification. On this vote, are we undoing what we did before, and we'll take a subsequent vote to send it to revenue?
Yes, we will.
So a yes vote brings us back to where we can send it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we'll have one. After this session, yeah, we'll have the vote. And we'll move it from there to revenue upon Representative Cruz's motion. Okay? Any further discussion? Representative Sepoy, we're moving House Bill 3606 back to revenue. We've moved it off the floor back to here because there was a revenue. Resulting revenue impact. Motion to reconsider at this point in time, but not the motion to send the revenue yet. Just reconsider. Okay.
A second time.
Any further discussion? Okay, those attending the committee reconsidered the rule by which House Bill 3606 was sent to floor will, with a due pass recommendation, will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Mackenzie?
Aye. Representative Devlin? Aye. Representative Janella? Aye. Representative Corey?
Aye.
Representative
Markley?
Aye.
Representative
Morgan?
Aye.
Mayor
Taylor?
Excuse.
Farewell.
Aye. The motion carries, and the vote to send House Bill 3606 to the floor with a due pass recommendation has been reconsidered. The bill is now before the committee as if it were never reported to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3606 to be referred to the Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation.
And Representative Cruz's motion is to refer the House Bill 3606 to the Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Devlin? Aye. Representative Janella? Aye. Representative Papori? Aye. Representative Markley? Aye. Representative
Morgan?
Aye.
Representative
Taylor?
Excuse.
Farewell.
Aye. Having required number of votes, the motion passes. And House Bill 3606 will go to revenue for due pass recommendation. Okay. Open a work session. Let's see, do we have any members in here? I don't think we do. two. Okay. And that one being on 3489. Okay, Lundquist, we're going to open in, open a work session on the House Bill 3489. We're absolutely on cue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think they're passing out some maps to help you through this process a little bit. This is a somewhat of a complicated issue, I guess, to say the least. And so what we have here, we have actually have five, we have three amendments. We have the 5, the 6, and the 7. The dash 5 were basically where we started from after we went through the three to try to get together. Before long, it became apparent we weren't going in anywhere with that, and so we sort of almost discarded them, but I have a map associated with that, just so you have to be convenient. We were looking at basically the 6 or the 7. In a general framework, the 6s are from the department, and the 7s are from the work group we put together, the department being part of that, of course, as well. Mr. Chairman, Reverend Morgan has been instrumental and has as good a grasp as I do on this particular issue that I've been trying to deal with. I would like to talk about the Dash 7 amendments,
okay.
if I might. Again, the map, I think, is the best way to try to follow this situation. The situation A, as you see on the first page of your map, that is basically the Dorvin situation where we have a parcel that is larger than the minimum of 80 acres. In this case, you see before you, it's 100 acres, and it's putting 15 acres off, and you still have the balance larger than the minimum necessary. And that's that one is probably the easiest part of this particular bill to understand. I do want you to note that the 15 acres of whatever size the parcel is cut off has to be generally unsuitable for ag purposes. It's a restriction that we have on that classification. Then we have in this bill, we have an east side and we have a west side. And you have to keep those two different because we treat them different in the process. If you turn to the second page of your map system there, we have the Eastern Oregon situation, and this would be now for this provision is provided in all cases where it is 80 acres or less. So you all understand that. It's already it's below the minimum parcel size. So that the question is, how do we divide that parcel that's less than the 80 acres? Now, the map you have before you, we have to show 40 acres. That could be 60, it could be 80. But in all those cases, the smallest size you can have would be 20 acres. So if you had an 80, it could be a 16 or 20, but it couldn't be 420. Okay? And we have restrictions there. It has to be generally unsuitable for agriculture. It has to be 90% non-irrigated. It has to be all non-irrigated. And it has to be 90% in the class 6 to 8 range. That's the east side 6, I guess, if you could define it that way. Now, if we go into the west side 6, in general, the difference between the east side and the west side is on the west side, typically they want to divide the parcel off into the smallest parcel size necessary for that activity. In other words, it's not where you try to keep it to 20 acres. They're saying here to make that parcel size as small as you can. In this particular case, if you have 30 acres, you can divide 10 acres off. Assuming that's the smallest, it could be 5, it could be smaller than that. And then you have the balance, whatever that particular parcel size might be to start. So that's the major differences we have between the east side and the west side. And actually, I should have probably asked that maybe Representative Morgan might like to come down and testify at the same time. I don't know where he'd like to do it from there, Representative Morgan, but we worked through this process together. And it's the dash sevens here that we've come to grips with. But Representative Morgan would like to join me, you'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we're trying to do here is to go back to a place where we can deal with divisions on non-farm land. So we're talking about agriculturally zoned land. We're also talking about land that's outside of the Willamette Valley, just to kind of give you the feel. So think of Eastern Oregon and think of Southern Oregon when you're looking at this bill. The dash sevens are kind of a, like Representative Lundquist said, kind of a conglomeration from a work group. And basically, as the representative said, there's two sections in them. One section deals with parcels that are above the minimum lot size to begin with, and the minimum lot size is mandated in the statute to be 80 acres on the west side and 160 acres on the east side. The Dorvenin didn't really affect that situation, so that one is just pretty much staying the same. What Dorvenin did affect was partitions, divisions for non-farm parcels that take place on pieces of land that are at or below the minimum lot size, and that is really what this is meant to deal with. And so maybe we should just kind of walk through this. The I don't have my annotated one here, so I'm kind of flailing upstream in the dark. The
I think one of the, Mr. Chairman, if I might, one of the major differences was we worked with the department. We, in this work group, worked in earnest trying to come to some common agreement, and we actually did not get to the final. We finally put out the one for the department, we put out the one for ours. And I want to point out a major difference, because you hear the department talk about this, I assume, in a little bit. Under the dash 60, if you'll look at the second page of your map, on the dash sixes. I just want to point that out. What they wanted, instead of having down to a 20-acre minimum, they wanted a 30-acre minimum. And being from Eastern Oregon and knowing there's a lot of, there are, the typical size parcel is either an 80 or a 40, that Matt, or could even be down to 20. Well, 20 is out of the picture because it can't be divided any further anyway. So, but the typical parcels are either 40 or 80. If you have a 30-acre minimum and you have a 40, you can't do anything. Because both parcels have to be 30. So you obviously can't get that out of it. So what it really says is, in the department's proposal, is that if you have less than 60, you can't divide. If I make that point. In other words, if it's the 60, you could have just barely the 30 and 30. But if it was 59, for example, you couldn't have both parcels equaling a maximum of 30, of 38. So that is one of the major differences between the departments and with the dash 7 amendments.
Did you make
that's in line, Chris. Looks like there's some other criteria in there, too, that they added in.
Yes, there are other criteria.
There is other criteria. The land that we're talking about here cannot be irrigated. In Eastern Oregon, you can't take the parcel down below 20 acres. In Western Oregon, outside the Willamette Valley, you can't take the parcel size bigger than a parcel that's absolutely necessary to accomplish the non-farm dwelling. There are restrictions about the soil classes, and in subsection E on line 9, we need to make a conceptual amendment to that one to change that to class 4 soils rather than class 5 soils.
Is that the dash 7?
This is in the dash 7, yes. There is also stipulations that the parcel that's created for the non-farm dwellings has to be generally unsuitable for commercial farm or forest use. In your mind's eye, think about the kind of land here that's in eastern Oregon and southern Oregon. In southern Oregon, you're probably going to be seeing some kind of rocky type land or steeply sloping land with poor soil quality that's obviously unsuitable for agricultural purposes. In eastern Oregon, you'll be looking in your mind at those sagebrush covered places with the rocks sticking out of them. This is the kind of land we're looking at. And what this addresses is back in the 70s when all the counties were busy writing their comprehensive plans, we were under some really stringent time constraints to get these things done and get them into the department to get them acknowledged. And that once you get outside of urban growth boundaries, at that point in time, you really didn't have any choice about how you could zone land other than to zone it for either farmland or agricultural land. And the reality of the situation is that there is a lot of land out there that isn't suitable for either forestry purposes or for agriculture purposes. And that was really that's the intent of what this bill is attempting to address. Those pieces of land that are really not suitable for agricultural purposes. And so that's why you see all these conditions in here that step you through a process to ascertain that this is flat, not good ag land. So you've got it can't be irrigated. You've got the 20-acre minimum in eastern Oregon, the as small as possible in western Oregon, the soil classification restrictions, the fact that you have to establish that the parcel that the Narn Farm dwelling is on is generally unsuitable for commercial farm or forest use, that the governing body of the county approving a division of land under this subsection shall determine that approval will not violate the standards described in 215-296-1, which are agricultural siting standards. And that's about all it does. This is the stability. Oh, this is this is an interesting thing here. In discussions with the department, there was a general recognition that one of the problems when you get into eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, that you have all this non-ag land that's caught in this agricultural land use classification. And there is a general recognition that that's a problem. And so in section 3 on page 4 is where the department will, this is really kind of a watershed thing here, the department will allow the county to look at larger areas within the county or the whole county for parts of, that again we're just talking about agriculturally zoned land, to see if there isn't a reason to exempt a chunk of land, a larger area of land than just a lot or just a parcel. And so the section 3 is a new innovative way of looking at this that will allow larger areas than just individually owned parcels to be exempted from agriculture land.
This is known, as and the department might use the term, a go-below option. In other words, if you could have the division for a large parcel, I mean for a large area, go below the minimum option. One other point that I'd like to make, if I might, we had lengthy discussions about what really existed prior to Dorvenham, and it's difficult, even with the department and 1,000 friends and the planner, it's difficult to come to a conclusion of exactly what happened, what was the situation prior to Dorvenham. But I can tell you, from the county that I live in, that we were dividing farm parcels that were in the farm use zone
that are non-farm parcels, and they weren't farm parcels, but we were dividing them into 20s, and out of an 80, you might get 4 20s. The reason I mention that is this. Actually, our proposal on Dash 7 still, in my opinion, does not go back to pre-Darwin. And there's a lot of people that would agree with that. I'm simply saying that we have already gone part way in regard to not going back and allowing as many decisions as we had before. So the department and 1,000 friends are rightfully concerned, how many divisions are we going to have in rural Oregon? And that's why I'm not supposed to be just dividing it one time.
Interesting truth.
Yeah, I was looking in the DAF 6s. Could you give me some feel for how much 20 cubic feet of tree actually is?
In Douglas County, you would be looking at the scrub oak and the drone covered hillside. That's why we took that provision out of there, because it really isn't a good assessment of non-farm parcels.
Well, I agree with that. I was just trying to get volume-wise.
It is below commercial forestry capability.
Considerably?
It would not be commercially viable.
Mr. Chairman, there's been crews hey, on the east side that most of us, a lot of just plain juniper, and it's not even commercial by definition.
But it says in the 6 that it's capable of, and so that's some expected of just in its very nature. I think if you assume that time conditions, even on the east side, let's say you had an exceptional wet year and warm springs and all that, so that if you had trees that could grow, they could grow more than normal, and so it almost seems to me like it's an unnecessary hurdle being put in here.
Well, bear in mind also that this is this relates to farmland, to agriculture land. It does not relate to forest land.
Any other question? Okay. As much as we got for time being. Hearing on House Bill 3489. And let's open a hearing on House Bill 2979. I'd like to have let's see. We can have Paul and Jay come up. Okay, we went over what? We had the Dash 5. Is there anything new you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Paul Hanneman, Cloverdale, Oregon, representing the seafood processors and a member of the original task force on waterways. Defer to Mr. McCauley, but my position is that I don't have anything to add to the Dash 5.
All right.
Jay McCauley, the record 1555 North Jansen Street, Portland 97217. Mr. Chair, I have nothing new to add to the Dash 5 amendments.
I know we want to come to some agreement here, but I think we're still a distance away. In fact, I think that we were treading very thin ice on policy on just about everything that we're trying to do here when we have asked when the land board is really a helpful decision maker in the process, and when we have a division also that has a responsibility and a charge provided in the from the legislature to go forward with deciding exactly what their assessment should be here. And I think that a little beyond what this committee should be making a decision on at present, it's when we get down to trying to decide exactly what those fees are and controlling those before, especially a final decision from the Division of State Lands. And I know that is supposed to come down in June. We'll hear their final decision. And that's, I think, very positive, because I don't think we can have that report before this committee. But we can also, and we have conceptual amendments that came from the department, and I think you have taken a look at those. At this time, I'm going to have to be very honest with you, that's as far as I would go on this bill at this time. Before I would not want to make any other considerations until I heard the final from the department and their final report in June 8th. And I want to let you know that so you could respond to that, and we could place that in the bill and pass it on to the Senate, or you'd give you an opportunity to continue to work with the department and with that language. Or dies here today. That is what the chair has made a decision on. So you can go back and discuss that. We can break here. We got plenty of other bills to work on, but I wanted to let you know, after reading a lot this weekend, about 16 hours, I didn't read that long, but I had plenty of information before me, the bill and everything else, and I think when we ask the department to do what the Division of State Lands is required to do, in my experience working with them, with the mining industry and everything else, I have to be very honest with you that I think they've been prudent and responsible in the past. You know, in the legislature, we have to decide with a history, and there's not going to be a lot with term limits. You know, which side we're going to fall on. I think we have some problems. I think there is some founding in your fear of where these assessments, these new lease fees will go. But as I looked at other states and comparing some of the information that they had requested from states and even British Columbia, I was looking at certainly high-value land, which is waterfront is, which I own some also in the family. But I also fear that we could go too far, and I think the division is quite aware that they can go too far in economically depressed areas. And that those of you that are in closer to Portland will carry the burden. I think they've heard that loud and clear. So we'll see in our June 8th report. I think we should wait for that before we have any legislative action. Paul?
Mr. Chair, thank you for expressing the Chair's opinion and position. I just arrived moments ago from the coast and was late getting here for your hearing today, your work session. We aren't sure about the nature of what's proposed in June before the land board, because unless my associates who were here at 1 o'clock have something that I don't have. The division hastens to label everything we have as preliminary. And until we see the language of what they're proposing and the nature of an agreement that was held in the director's office in the Division of State Lands offices with the director of the division and chief of staff, John Lewis, also labeled preliminary. As a matter of fact, that was labeled suggested. Unless we see those, we still aren't sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what it is specifically and absolutely that the division will come with at the June meeting. Mr. McCollier, do you have something I don't have regarding actual presentation before the land board?
Mr. Chair and committee, just prior to the meeting, Mr. Lilly handed us some proposed amendments as well as some preliminary proposed rules that may be coming forth at that June land board meeting. We have not had a chance to go through that material at this stage.
Okay. That's fair. Appreciate that. I knew you wouldn't have either. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, then in closing, we hear your direction, and we would hope that within the next day or two, the division has indicated they will solidify some of their proposals so that we can see exactly what is going to be presented in June. We'll have a better idea to know how to answer your question on whether this bill has opportunities yet in some amended form or whether perhaps we don't need to have legislation. But I might add again that this has been nearly 40 years of what many waterway leases consider inequities, some properties with no leases at all that have been overlooked. And I'm charging right here now that there have been political considerations, not by this director, but by governors, secretary of states, and state treasurers in the past, and their directors under the four previous ones that have given preferential treatment to some people and socked it to others. And it's those equities, inequities, that our group had hoped to help resolve. We still believe that it's the legislature's right to, in some of these areas, to determine policy for the division, even in a state like ours, where the three top elected officials control state lands. Now, the current director was successful in mediating agreements east of the Cascades on those leases out there, and the associations and organizations in the cattle industry and others were satisfied. Made some headway to meet our problems also and attempt to resolve those. But again, my last comment would be, until we see those, we would appreciate the committee keeping its options open on the bill, and we appreciate all the time you've taken with it to try to understand an issue that's involved in the Constitution, the Admissions Act, and current state law. Very complex. And thanks again.
Well, I appreciate it. We appreciate your work. And we have, let me know before Friday. I'll put it back on the calendar. Okay.
Representative Welch, Chairman Welch, I'd like to make one brief comment. If nothing else, I appreciate what the committee has done here in bringing this as far as we have to this moment. You know, in my mind, having worked with the division for 4 years on this program now, I can tell you that they haven't budged an inch in regard to some of these contentious issues in this 4-year process. I think to a large degree, these last-minute
proposals and changes are a result of your scrutiny, considerations that you've given us in regard to this bill. Let's see what the division is proposing, and we'll report back to the committee as you see fit. Thank you very much, Chairman Welch, and the indulgence of the committee.
Maybe some questions here.
I just want to make a comment that the lefties we're talking about here, many of them are within my district. And as you know, I've met with them, I've met with the division, I've gone to the hearings, I've spoken to that here. I do believe the division has budged an inch. Just at our last hearing, I heard that the upland proposal had been decreased from 6% of the upland value to 5%. If indeed that's the proposal, the things I'm hearing is that that decreases the leases for many of the people that I represent. And for me, that's a good thing. I'm sorry that I can't concur that they haven't budged. I believe that they have tried to listen and work with the lessees, and so I just wanted to note that. Thank you.
Another question? Thank you. Okay, we'll close hearing on House Bill 2979. Now we'll open a hearing on the House Bill 2865. Yeah, do we have to explain in here at all?
I don't think so.
Any others would like to, yeah, John's close by. We'll come. Yeah, I think we have to do that. If we have to do that.
Do you have an amendment?
We were looking for these round two.
Yes.
Okay.
Have they revised them?
Let's find out real quick. And we'll
put some new out this year.
Yeah. We 28.
It's coming in a picture box.
I was cracking on that too. I think we'll wait until we have those in hand. I was expecting them about 2 o'clock. I think we'll close our hearing on House Bill 2865, and we'll see what we have here as far as checking the sign up on Senate bills. Okay, let's open a hearing on Senate Bill 615. We have John Chandler. Outside.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 615A authorizes the Land Conservation and Development Commission to exempt cities with populations less than 10,000 and areas inside urban growth boundaries to with populations less than 10,000 from land use planning goals and administrative rules that relate to transportation planning. Requires departments of land conservation and development to report to the 61st Legislative Assembly.
71st.
I'd be having all the time if I didn't get 61st, I would think.
Yes, he was left in here.
I'm getting out of here, I'll have to go.
Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs of the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 615. By way of explanation on this bill, this bill did not start out as being ours, but it kind of followed us home in the Senate proceedings. It was a bill introduced by Senator Tarno and some other folks that did a bunch of things that we didn't think needed to be done, so we worked with the department on some amendments and came up with the Aiding Girls version, Senate Bill 615. What it does, essentially, is it allows, as Bill says, citizens of a population of under 10,000 to ask at DLCD, or LCDC rather, for an exemption from the transportation planning rule. It says more than that, but that's the gist of it. Transportation planning rule implements statewide planning rule 12. It is not in the statutes and the administrative rules. It requires jurisdictions to do planning for connectivity, to sidewalks, bike paths, to look at street widths, all sorts of other things. We haven't been a big fan of the transportation planning rule since its inception. In fact, the day it was adopted back in 1991, my appendix burst, and I believe that was a direct causal relationship. I haven't figured out a lawsuit, but I'm sure there's one there someplace. We haven't been able to do much about the TPR in terms of modifying it. We've done some modifications over the years at the LCDC. We have not been able to make it go away. This bill doesn't make it go away. What it does is allow jurisdictions up to 10,000 to ask LCDC to not have to play. Currently, the rules, the LCDC rules allow jurisdictions up to 2,500 to ask for that exemption. What this does is raise the 2,500 to 10,000. It does not require that LCDC do anything. They can be asked by jurisdictions of 10,000 under this bill, and they can decline to exempt them. My assumption would be that the more rural, smaller cities might qualify for exemptions under this bill. Those cities that were closer to urban areas, closer to larger urban areas, where their transportation planning might affect that going on in the larger city, probably would not be allowed an exemption. But that's just a guess, because the commission would be authorized under this legislation to make those calls. We believe it's a good bill. We think that the 2,500 threshold in the current law is too low. I don't think any great violence is done by allowing jurisdictions up to 10,000 to ask. The bill does also provide that the LCDC is to report back next session on how they did. The reason for that concern, and those of you who represent some of these smaller cities probably understand this, the compliance with the transportation planning rule can be fairly extensive at the local level. It is, there are grants available through LCDC. There's not enough grant money there to go around, as normally the case. And consequently, jurisdictions end up having to spend staff time complying with this rule when in a particular situation they may or may not feel that it's necessary to do so. This will allow at least those smaller cities to go make a case to the commission as to why they shouldn't have to make those expenditures and spend that time. It wasn't our bill at the outset, but we like it. We commend it to you. We hope you'll put it on before due pass. I'll be glad to take any questions you might have.
Yeah, and John, what 10,000 is cut off there? Is that subject that you can get agreement on? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, basically, yes. We were asking for $5 million, but it didn't work out that way.
Well, which would exempt from...
They saw through that strategy, unfortunately.
Okay. I guess the reason for the question is you get, communities like Roseburg, which is certainly larger than 10,000, but is so isolated as to be disconnected from anything else, and you trust. I see other criteria that could come into play here, whereas close to Portland, a community of 10,000, it may be essential that they have connectivity. So I'm wondering what was the roadblock from going to other criteria here other than just population?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, the population is usually the cutoff. That's a nice shorthand cutoff to get you. It also happened to correlate rather nicely with a couple of districts on the coast that had a number of tussles over this, where the cities that had the squabbles over transportation planning generally and TPR in particular. And it's important to note, if I can, Mr. Chairman, that this only relates to the transportation planning rule. We try to draft it in such a way that we aren't affecting transportation system plans, which are currently authorized by statute and required by ODOT. We're trying to address only the TPR piece of LCDC's language, and because Ledge Council takes into hives every time you try to reference an administrative rule by its common name, we have to do a kind of a circular approach. That was the intention. In regard to the population cutoff, we would certainly be supportive of a higher one. I'm not sure that we could make that stick.
Open this with the try, though.
Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chamber, won't this just give cities something else to fight over?
I'm thinking about some controversy within one of the cities under 10,000 in my district, and there are citizens there who want bike paths, and there are those who don't, but since they're called for, you know. It's part of what has fed the, those kinds of controversies are part, I believe, of what has fed the move to get local votes on annexations, which is not consistent with land use planning. And it's interesting to me that my same residents, constituents who support land use planning also support the initiative to vote on annexation. And when I ask them why, what they tell me is it's because our county is not doing their job right. They're not going by the land use laws. So here we're giving that county another opportunity to do something different than we have been calling for. Do you see my point?
Mr. Elizabeth Taylor, I think I do. I would refer you to the language in line 11 on page 2, which says the commission may exempt.
I know.
I'm not privy to whatever thinking the commission might have on this. I'd be surprised if any of the jurisdictions in your county would be allowed exemptions simply because it's proximity to the port. That's, again, just a guess. But I think rather than giving something to fight about, I think it may be a way for the commission to work with local governments. In many cases, and I can think of several cases where I believe they're spending time on transportation planning rule compliance that probably should be spent doing some other piece of the land use system.
To clarify, I don't mean that the Land Conservation Development Commission. I mean the county commission. Well, if they apply to opt out of this rule, there will be a reaction from some half the citizens, and there'll be half who probably support it. Another dispute cause. I guess I'm not making myself clear, but it's my concern.
Ms. Chairman, I'm shocked at the motion to be dissent in Columbia County.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chandler, I hate to give you this kind of an opening.
No, we can't do school after you see us.
Why would you want to do something like this? I'll give you an example. City of Sherwood, when I represented on the Metro Council, had about 3,000 or 4,000 people. Right now it has just under, should have about 10,000, maybe just under 10,000. Why would you ever want to consider exempting them, given the fact that if they plan correctly, they won't end up like their large neighbor to the north, Tiger, which has a few traffic problems that people know about.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard about Tiger's traffic problems. I wouldn't exempt Sherwood. I think it's highly unlikely that the commission would exempt Sherwood. I mean, Sherwood is exactly the type of jurisdiction that ought to be, much I hate to admit it, as long as we've got the thing on the books, I would be required to comply with it. There are jurisdictions, though, that are not in proximity to the metro area or to any metro area that probably are spending money and time on transportation planning that they don't need to. The city of Burns comes to mind, for example. Burns may well have traffic problems that like nobody's business, I doubt it. And they probably have some other things they could do with their time and money than figure out where to run the bike paths.
Mr. Chairman, I could just so I can get Mr. Chandler on the record, you wouldn't exempt Cornelius either, would you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, if the commission exempts any jurisdiction within a par 5 of the metro boundary, I'd be very surprised.
Okay.
Doesn't mean they won't ask, but I won't get.
Mr. Sheriff?
Yes, go ahead.
I do agree that there's obvious places that should be exempted, and one of them is the town that I come from, Myrtle Creek, 3,600 people, and it's had the same population for the last 10 or 15 years. And truly, we do have much better things to spend our meager planning dollars on than figuring out transportation plans. I was curious about when this was discussed on the Senate side, if there was any discussion about what the criteria would be that the department would use in their discussions about exemption.
Chairman Representative Morgan, I don't recall specifically. I think proximity to urban areas was one that did come up. And the language in Section 2 of the having the department report back next session was kind of a surrogate for getting into the discussion about the criteria now. There was a feeling on the part of the committee, I believe, that if LCDC had to come back and say what they did and why they did it, that would suffice for now rather than get into the nitty-gritty of trying to figure it out. Because frankly, I think there's a number of, for every, I think Myrtle Creek would be a great example of one that probably could be excused without the land use system in Oregon taking a fatal hit. But to sit down and write full standards in the Senate and in the legislative context would probably be inappropriate. I think that's more of a rulemaking function. One thing I might mention too, Mr. Chairman, is that there's another bill that will be coming through, Senate bill, I believe it's going through the General Government Committee, that got the support of the governor and the LCD and a bunch of us that are just doing the issue of periodic review and trying to focus LCD's attention and focus their efforts. And in that bill, we're doing some exempting of smaller cities and smaller counties. And I think one of the things that this bill and those other bills recognize is that we've had a system in the state that applied across the board. It applied to Myrtle Creek the same way it applied to Cornelius. And the pressures in those two jurisdictions are entirely different. And what probably ought to be required in a Cornelius, where it is a part of the metro boundary and does have a significant amount of growth pressure, probably doesn't need to be applied to Myrtle Creek. And I think it's a maturation of the land use planning system, recognizing that not every place is a Sherwood, or will go from 3,000 to 10,000. Some places will stay at 3,000 for the next 15, 20 years, and consequently the need for the level of planning that we would impose on Sherwood probably doesn't have to be imposed there. And that was the idea behind this bill, was to grant, 2,500 when the TPR was adopted in 1991, if you adjust for inflation, so to speak, that going up 10,000 probably isn't that big of a stretch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that coastal areas have been having problems with this particularly. Could you be more specific?
Mr. Chairman, Taylor, I believe there was a fairly well-documented squabble down in Florence.
Mr. Chair, if I may continue. I know that Florence is a small city, but it's a city that's visited by so many people, as a lot of coastal communities are. And it seems to me that transportation on the coast, planning for transportation there, includes a lot more than just for the population. It has to plan for the visitors that come there. We had a good example of that in Astoria last year when the USS Missouri came, and 125,000 people came to our town, and there was gridlock for 25 miles in each direction. So we would not be exempt, because I think we've got 10,090 persons and, in fact, want to do transportation planning. But it's my concern that if we exempt small coastal cities, that we will not be doing we will do a disservice, actually, to the coastal area. I wonder if it wouldn't be better to enable them somehow to do the planning they need to do, to either help them with technical assistance or with resources, rather than exempt them.
First of all, let me be real clear. I was using those cities as an answer to the Cruiser question about why 10,000 was picked, not as advocating for it should or shouldn't be subject. Given the fact that LCDC was party to an appeal out of the transportation issue in Florence, I think it's extremely unlikely that Florence would be granted an exemption. I don't like CPR in the first place, but I don't think Florence would be exempt under this bill. I agree with your point about encouraging and making it more possible. The reality is that every time we've come to the legislature, and I'll say we because we've always been supportive of the Transportation Growth Management Program and DLCD Technical Assistance Grants, it's fairly involved procedure getting money out of this body for that, mainly because of other priorities. If there's enough money in the system at the state level to help local government do the things the state has told them they ought to go do, that'd be a different story. Unfortunately, the legislature and not this current one, mind you, but previous legislatures, and the agencies are fairly careless about telling local governments to go and do stuff, then kind of forget and send a check along. And that puts local government in a very difficult spot, and oftentimes leads local government officials, of which I used to be one, to say, wait a second, you know, we don't have the money to do it. If you think it's a good idea, help us out. Or, in the alternative, if you don't have the money to help us out, let us off the hook upon a certain showing that we don't need to be on the hook in the first place. The department is okay with this language, has agreed to the $10,000 cap. I don't believe they would have agreed to it if they thought there would be violence done, and I think that what will end up happening is that a Burns or a Myrtle Creek may well come in after an exemption and have it granted. Forest may well come after one, but I'll bet you a cookie they don't get it. Nor would St. Helens or Scappoose, I believe. So that's my opinion. I think that what we tried to set up was a process through which the smaller cities, where the growth pressure isn't as large, where the need for the transportation system planning or transportation planning rule compliance isn't as large, could ask for an exemption. And it may well be to come back next session and the LCD will report that these 10 cities asked, none of them were approved.
Other questions?
One more, if I may.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair.
We don't have any indication. I should have looked in our calendar information about the vote on that, if it was unanimously reported on the Senate side, or?
Mr. Chair, members, I have information that it passed 20-7 on the Senate side, so if you excuse.
I think this is pretty helpful. You know, my senator is a long-term member of the Transportation Committee, and she opposes it, and I'll have to do the same.
Mm-hmm. We've got more testimony here. Any other questions? Mr. Chandler. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Bob Rindy.
Good afternoon. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I don't have a great deal more to offer than what Mr. Chandler has told you. The department is neutral on this bill. I will point out that the intent, as I understand it, is for LCDC to adopt some rules that would come up with some criteria for how the commission would exempt cities under 10,000 from the transportation planning requirements. Since 1991, we have had an authorization in our rules for cities under 2,500 to be exempt. Somewhere around 12 or 13 cities have sought and obtained full or partial exemptions from the TPR. And that's a small percentage of the cities that are eligible, and I think what we're going to see is the same thing with the larger cities. That is to say, most cities won't seek this exemption, and I'll tell you why. As long as a city has to comply with the transportation planning rule, they are more likely to receive the grant funding, most of which is passed down from the federal government, to do transportation planning. About 90% of the TPR work done by cities has been funded, and most of that passed through from federal highway funds. We had a budget note last time that our grant dollars had to be prioritized to things that were required as opposed to those things that jurisdictions might want to do. So as soon as this is something that's not required, a city obtains an exemption, they might find they're unable to obtain state and federal funding for transportation planning. And that's unfortunate. We wish we had more funding for the planning work people want to do. But that's the reason I don't think cities will seek this exemption. In fact, City of Florence officials wrote a letter indicating their support for transportation planning, and we're very happy at the support they've received to do that so far. The transportation planning that is done at the local level is the best opportunity for cities to really have a say for transportation improvements in their area. And that's generally why there's broad local support for the kind of planning that the TPR outlines. I don't know the kind of criteria we would use. I think initially we would look at the criteria that exist right now for exempting the smaller cities, and I don't have those with me, I apologize, but they, as I recall, they are generally have to do with growth pressure and the proximity to larger jurisdictions such as metro.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Moore.
With the current exemption, do you have a recollection of who's gotten that exemption, what kind of towns we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we did submit to the record on the Senate side a list of those 12 or 13 jurisdictions. They're not in your record. That was something we submitted with our testimony, and I know we have it. I don't have it listed today, but I can get that for you right away.
I'd be curious to know just kind of the general flavor of those kinds of communities that qualified for the program. Were they like Eastern Oregon communities or all over the state?
Representative Morgan, I believe they were all over the state, but I don't recall. I think Shanico was one. And generally fairly small jurisdictions. And in general, when they sought that exemption, they were authorized by the commission. There generally wasn't a lot of opposition to that. And the factors that we've used there could probably work just as well for larger cities. We have the authorization to use any number of factors, and certainly suggestions on your part. We don't have any idea as to what those would be. We might even consider the condition of Mr. Chandler's appendix. But, anything. We could use any factor we want. And unless there's a legislative record on what you're considering, that rulemaking would go forward, and you could come in and ask for those. But we will report back to you next session as to what kind of a rule we've adopted, how many jurisdictions have asked for that exemption, and what the commission's disposition was.
Can I have a follow-up?
Yes, go on.
Does a set of rules exist for exempting the smaller cities right now?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morgan, yes.
Would it be possible also to get that, means you're going to get us the list of the cities too?
I'll certainly get that to you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Ferdy. Lynn Peterson, and I think Edgar Bomer.
Chair Welch and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Peterson, transportation advocate for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm here today to at least strongly oppose Senate Bill 615. While we agree with the underlying message that the state should not require unnecessary planning, Senate Bill 615 goes too far in allowing 197 cities with populations under 10,000 to be exempted by DLCD from transportation planning. I have two basic points to make on this. The transportation planning rule already contains the necessary flexibility for the cities under 25,000 and allows for less stringent requirements for those cities. Approximately half of those cities under the TPR are working to adopt or have adopted transportation system plans, even though they're under that cutoff line of 2,500. Transportation planning is necessary for all five cities. As you can see on the back of the handout, there's a sampling of cities that would be eligible to request exemption from the transportation planning rule based on their 1998 population, and you can see their percent population increase next to that as you handed it out. The population growth should definitely be considered one of those criteria that you were just talking about. Many of the cities that would qualify under this new rule have or are experiencing increased growth rates. In fact, you can see that 20% of the 197 had high growth rates and 35% had moderate growth rates. So we're talking 55% of the cities under this rule have moderate to high growth rates. Then there's the coordination that's necessary when you look at these issues. There are many transportation system plans need to include all these things that are included in the transportation planning rule that looks at how to coordinate between the state, the county, and the city. And the importance of this, as you well noted, Representative Taylor, is along the coast, where you have many of those coastal communities are completely reliant upon the state for their transportation needs. So it would be very difficult for a small community with a high growth rate to decide how they're going to do a transportation system plan or have a local network that doesn't completely rely on the state and still coordinate how to get that transportation system to meet their needs. And I'd also like to point out a kind of a background of why they chose the 2,500 population cutoff. Back when they did that, these requirements were enacted during Oregon's last recession to ensure that smaller cities had the infrastructure in place to attract businesses, an economic development question. Businesses go to where there are sewer, roads, and water in place or plan to be in place. Removing this requirement creates a critical economic development tool for small cities. Then there's the idea of transportation choices. Many of these smaller cities have the ability to walk and bike more freely than the bigger urban areas because they have the type of infrastructure in place to do that, and they must continue to keep that infrastructure in place as they grow. And lastly, citizens must be able to have their voices heard, and local jurisdictions should be able to educate citizens on the costs and benefits of all the decisions relating to building or delaying a project and funding issues. When a debate takes place in an open forum, the community learns to balance the needs of all its citizens. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm available for questions.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Air and Transportation Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. And OEC also opposes Senate Bill 615. I won't repeat Lynn's testimony, but try to sum it up by saying that transportation is simply not something that should be planned in a vacuum. That's why we have transportation planning rules that help promote economic development and intelligent land use. I can see many situations where a small city might have many pressing needs and feel like it should put off its transportation planning requirements to its detriment in the future, and possibly to the detriment of cities around it that are connected. This is an interconnected system. So that's why transportation is a statewide issue, not just a local issue. There may be a few cities that don't need to do this type of planning, but we worry that the criteria upon which to exempt those cities simply isn't in place. So this is putting the cart before the horse. Perhaps the legislature should come up with a bill that says to DLCD, figure out what these criteria are before passing a bill that would say go out and exempt cities based on perhaps whim. So that's just to sum up the fact that we also oppose 615, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
The interconnectedness, if you get outside of the Llano Valley, you'll see the interconnectedness is 1675 miles apart, which is rather dubious. You know, there's nothing here that prohibits a city from planning their transportation system. All this does is exempt them from certain rules set up by the state for that plan. And I guess I have a problem seeing how bike paths are part of economic development.
Chair Welsh, Representative Cruz, not to get into debate about whether bike paths are an economic tool, but they have been shown to increase property values and tourism in the areas that they've been placed in. And I think that's just one of the things that we're talking about. We're not talking necessarily about bike paths, but we're identifying the barriers to biking. For instance, there might be a road that has very high volumes, an arterial, or maybe even a state highway that's the main street that goes through town, and identifying whether a bike can get to this main part of town is part of the transportation planning rule and part of a transportation system plan that might not necessarily be done. And when the state comes through and says, we're going to do an overlay through your town, the city should take that opportunity to say, let's try and recreate our downtown. If they don't have it in their transportation system plan, they might not be able to do that. It won't be as high a priority for, say, the state to then go ahead and help that small town.
I think what we've got here is another case of assuming that folks in small towns aren't capable of planning for themselves without the state telling them exactly everything that needs to be planned for. Is that basically what you're saying? If we don't impose all these rules on small communities like Burns and Myrtle Creek, that they're going to make a total mess of it by themselves.
Chair Walsh, Representative Cruz, that's not what I was implying at all. What I was saying was that we have various jurisdictions over different roads. And by implementing the transportation planning rule and allowing every jurisdiction, all the different layers, the city can then talk to the county and say, this is our prioritization. We would like to be able to see bikes on our main street. If bikes can't get to the main street right now, then how are we going to implement that? And then as the county or the state comes through to maintain their road, which is the main street, because the main street doesn't necessarily belong to that jurisdiction, that little town.
Well, I understand that, but so you're saying that if we exempt Myrtle Creek from this rule, that they can no longer talk to the city or to the county or the state?
Chair Walsh, Representative Cruz, no. What I'm saying is that it's part of a documented process. It's a public process, and it's gone through, and they've identified in a plan what they want to do. It's, by exempting them, you might not be able to identify. It will no longer be a requirement to identify those barriers to alternative modes or how to do that economic development portion of their plan.
I gotta go.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you. Anyone else want to give testimony on Senate Bill 615? Okay, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 615. We're going to go to, we're going to go to 2865. I saw kind of a ad hoc work group without time. Yeah, I don't have all the amendments here for us. So we'll go on to open a hearing on Senate Bill 8.3.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 863, Planning Growth, requires local governments to make a land use decision within 90 days of receiving decision on remand from the Land Use Board of Appeals.
And Mr. Chamber. And Mr. Hunter.
Sure.
I don't know if Senator Turner was coming in, but I saw him on his. I doubt it. I didn't hear that he was.
Chair Welsh, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of Senate Bill 863. Senate Bill 863 imposes a requirement on local government that they actually decide a case when it comes back from the Land Use Board of Appeals or the Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court. Under the current law, when you file an application in the first instance, the local government has 120 days or 150, depending on whether it's city or county and what the application is for, to make a final decision. And if they don't make a decision within that time period, you have the authority to go into circuit court and ask the judge essentially to make the choice for them. But when a case comes back from LUBA, Land Use Board of Appeals, or the Oregon Supreme Court or the Oregon Court of Appeals on a remand, when the local government makes the decision in the first instance and it gets appealed up to the appellate courts and then comes back, there's no requirement for the local government to do anything on it. And so what you have is a situation where a local government can essentially sit on an application when it comes back and never do anything, which you'd think that wouldn't happen, but that actually happened in the case Holland versus City of Cannon Beach. And if I can read from the concurring opinion by Judge Hazelton from the Court of Appeals, I just want to put this into the record. Perhaps unwittingly, the legislature has created a statutory scheme that, one, requires local governments to dispose of land use applications within 120 days in the first instance, but, two, allows local governments to consign the same applications to legal limbo following successful appeals to LUBA. Mr. Holland's odyssey to LUBA, this court, the Supreme Court, this court again, and LUBA again yielded a pyrrhic victory. His application can now languish indefinitely before the city of Cannon Beach. If that is the legislature's intent, so be it. But to describe that result as incongruous is far too mild, and Maine is more like it. So I don't think you don't get too many concurring opinions from Court of Appeals judges that are essentially saying the legislature ought to fix this. But that is one of those concurring opinions. What the judge, I think, was saying is that the legislature ought to take a look, have a process for a land use applicant to go to circuit court and ask the circuit court if the city decides or the county decides not to do anything on a case when it comes back to them, ask the court to order them to do that. 863 does that. And at the end of 90 days, if a local government gets a case back from LUBA and they don't do anything with it within 90 days, you have the authority to go to the circuit court and ask the court to order them to make a decision. That's all that 863 does. We worked out some amendments on the Senate side. There was no opposition. I believe it came out either 28 to nothing or 29 to nothing, 30 to nothing, something like that on the Senate side. I have one conceptual amendment I'd like to propose, simply because I got a call from the county, from the court clerk's office. And this, the way it's drafted now, we've got a procedural problem that I believe we can fix with a conceptual amendment. So I have one conceptual amendment I'd like to propose. Other than that, great deal.
Sure. Go ahead with that.
Okay.
Tell us where.
The problem is in Section 3 and Section 6, Subsection 1. What we were trying to get at, if the local, your right to file a lawsuit in circuit court only arises if the local government doesn't do anything on remand within 90 days. And what happens, what you would file for what's called a writ of mandamus. You would ask the court to order, essentially, the local government to make a decision. When you file a writ of mandamus, you file what's called a petition, typically a petition for an alternative writ. That's like filing a complaint. It initiates the lawsuit. We wanted the courts to hear these cases quickly because you've already waited 90 days and don't have a decision, and now all the judge is saying is sending it back to the city and ordering the city to make a decision. So we wanted the courts to decide these quickly. So we put in the language on page 1 of line 2 that says that it starts actually on page 28 of line, or on page 1, line 28. The court shall set the matter for trial as soon as practicable, but not more than 15 days from the date the petition is filed. That won't work because the petition is essentially the complaint, and you have to give the local government an opportunity to answer your petition. And if the court has to schedule it for trial within 15 days from the time the petition is filed, you don't give the local government any time to file a response. So the 15 days, the setting of the case for trial should be 15 days from the date the response is filed, not the date the petition is filed. So the proposed amendments that would apply on page 2, line 1, and page 2, line 33, you would delete the word the petition, and it would, and insert the words a responsive pleading pursuant to ORS 34.170. So that sentence would read, the court shall set the matter for trial as soon as practicable, but not more than 15 days from the date a responsive pleading pursuant to ORS 34.170 is filed. Which what we're trying to get at is that we want the court to set it from the time the local government files an answer.
What was that ORS again?
34.170. That's the section in the mandamus section in statute that gives the local governments the authority to file responses. So if they choose to file a response, then the court would set the case for trial within 15 days after the time they filed that answer, as opposed to 15 days from the time you filed your petition. With that, the bill works. There was no opposition.
Mr. Chair. Representative Mercury.
Question on Section 2.
In the first subsection of Section 2, the 90 days begins with the effective date of the final order. The section, subsection 2A, line 15, it notes that the period does not begin until the applicant requests the county proceed with the application. So it seems like the clock is being set really from when the applicant requests that the county proceed. Would that affect at all other provisions where the 90-day clock is referred to within this, and would it affect the 16-day clause that you're currently conceptually amending?
Chair Welsh, Representative Merkley, it wouldn't affect the 15-day clock, because the 15-day clock doesn't start until you filed your writ of mandamus action in circuit court, which doesn't start until the 90 days expires. It wouldn't affect the other 90-day provisions in subsection 2 of section 2, because it's in addition to the requirements of subsection 1 of section 2. So in other words, the 90-day period starts when the time for appealing the decision, if it's out of LUBA to the Court of Appeals, ends, and the landowner asks, or the land use applicant asks the local government to start making the decision. What they wanted to get out there, there were concerns expressed, I believe, by the local government folks that it was difficult to tell when the 90-day time frame started. So we wanted to put the burden on, they wanted to put the burden on the land use applicant to actually start to trigger the 90 days. We didn't have a problem with that. That certainly sounds reasonable to us.
Any other questions here? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler, again, Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association here on 863. Mr. Honeycutt summed it up very nicely. This closes a loophole in Oregon law, one that has been called out by the courts and has been used by local governments on occasion in a not too polite fashion. It's silly to have cases that have to go through 120-day process at the front end and have no process at all on remand. This sets up that time frame. No opposition, good bill. Thank you. Any questions? I'll be right there.
Other questions? Okay. Is there anyone else?
Yes.
I'd like to get testimony on this. I only had two signing up. Doesn't look like we have any opposition.
Mr. Chair.
That's in Kapori.
Can we ask what was the vote on the Senate side on this one?
Yeah, we did. I think it was the vote.
28 zip.
28 zip to...
Excuse.
Okay. We have a conceptual before, and we can move on this bill. We don't have any opposition. I'll work into a work session here. Take a look at that. See how the committee feels. Close the hearing on House Bill 863. Open a work session on. Close on Senate Bill 863. And open a work session on Senate Bill 863.
Sure.
Okay, Cruz.
I move to consult to amend Senate Bill 863 by, on page 2, line 1, deleting the petition and inserting a responsive pleading pursuant to ORS 34.170.
Is that the right reference? Okay.
And on line 33, deleting the petition and inserting the same language.
That's a free move that we accept the conceptual amendment. It's on page 2, line 1.
And line 33.
And line 33, with the same language, replacing the petition and inserting a responsive pleading pursuant to ORS 34.170. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
In
the context of this bill, in the responsive pleading, I believe it's the only language in this bill. It doesn't refer to filing the petition. It doesn't refer to filing your request for the county to proceed. If you could clarify, please, what it actually refers to. Clarify the responsive pleading. What exactly that is in the context of this bill, since it doesn't appear elsewhere.
Sure. Chair Welsh, Representative Merkley, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon, is in action. The responsive pleading would be when I file a petition for a writ of mandamus, the responsive pleading is what the local government would file in response if they were going to challenge my petition for a writ. It's essentially the same thing as an answer. In a lawsuit, you file, the plaintiff files a complaint, the defendant files an answer. In this case, the plaintiff, in a writ of mandamus action, the plaintiff landowner would file a petition for a writ. The local government would file either an answer or a motion to dismiss, which both of which are responsive pleadings. They're pleadings in response to the petition.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any opposition? Hearing none. So we move.
Sure. I would move Senate Bill 863 as conceptually amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves Senate Bill 863 as conceptually amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Okay. Will the clerk please call the vote?
Aye.
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 Senator Morgan?
Aye.
Senator
Taylor?
Aye.
Farewell. Aye. The required number of votes, Senate Bill 863 as amended, as conceptually amended, passed to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Carrier, anyone would like to carry this? Representative Demmer will be our carrier. Thank you. We close the work session on Senate Bill 863, and I think we shall open our, let's open the work session on House Bill 2865. We have plenty of participants, I think, on this. Now, what we're referring to, and it's being handed out right now, is our dash 4 amendment to this particular session. And an ongoing work group that is going to work on this for, well,
at least a month.
Quite a while here. I think longer than a month, hasn't it been?
Yeah.
We've been trying to resolve
years.
Yeah, just for years, and maybe we're closer than we've ever been, which would be nice. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Weist with the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and with me is Don Schellenberg from the Oregon Farm Bureau, and Don and I were delegated by the work group to present this bill to you today. This bill, well, I guess the song in Oklahoma about the cowboys and the farmers should be friends, this is probably the personification of that issue. What I'd like to do for the committee is give you a brief history of why we're here today, talk about who worked on the work group, what the Dash 4 amendments do, what they don't do, and then hopefully, with the committee's permission, pass the amendments you have out in front of you today to the Senate. Essentially, why we're here is that beginning with Senate Bill 100, the land use statute, as this committee well knows, lists the use that are allowable outright and then subject to conditions in exclusive farm use zones. One of those uses is utility services are listed as what is so-called sub 1 issue, which means they are allowed outright. Utility lines, extensions, etc., are allowed outright in exclusive farm use zones. However, the statute conditions that by saying that they are utilities that are necessary for public service. So if you look at the draft amendments, and if you look at line 11 of page 1, you'll see the existing language where it says utility facilities necessary for public service. And that is existing language. So that language has always been in the statute. And what has happened over the last 25 years is that slowly but surely, different interpretations have been made of the word necessary, which have culminated in some court cases, in a LUBA case, and in some individual decisions by county hearings officers who, in some counties, there is a hearings officer process required, and these hearings officers have all defined the word necessary. And we have wound up with a state of confusion, I guess is the polite way to put it, over just what this means, and we have wound up with a recent LUBA decision where the word necessary was defined to say only if there is no feasible alternative. That language was problematical because we've now got a new word, feasible, plus we don't know what that means. Is no feasible alternative, you can run the power line by helium balloon out over the farmland, or does that mean standard practices are not feasible? The result of all this is that really both farm interests and utility interests have found themselves with a little bit of a crapshoot on what all this means when individual applications and utility extensions come into play. With that in mind, the Special Districts Association along with the City of Newburgh introduced a bill, which is House Bill 2865, and we went the direct route, which was to change the definition of the word necessary. But after our bill came out, the Farm Bureau also had a bill, which is in another committee, we don't know why, but is in another committee, which defines necessary how the Farm Bureau would like to have it. And then there was yet a third bill that just simply prohibited extensions out into farmland. So the governor's office contacted all of us, suggested that we form a working group, and offered a mediator up, who was David Stewart Smith from the Department of Energy. And the with the mediator, we formed a work group, which has been working, seems like the entire session, but I know it must not be that long, on this issue, trying to draft a compromise that would hopefully protect the interests of the farm community when it comes to utility, but at the same time allow us to do reasonable utility extensions, because often our facilities that serve within urban growth boundaries are located outside of urban growth boundaries, such as a water intake or sewer plant, and at the same time farmers need utilities too. So how do we balance all these competing issues? And what you have before you is the result of that, which is the -4 amendments proposed. I'd like to quickly, before I go through the amendments, say who was on the group, and I'm sure I will leave somebody out. But the group involved the League of Cities, Special Districts, the Farm Bureau, electric, the private electric and gas utilities, cell phone folks attended some of the meetings, interstate transmission companies, Thousand Friends of Oregon, Department of Ag, City of Portland, City of Newburgh, and we had a representative who represented several small cities in Yamhill County. The cities of Yamhill, Sheridan, Carleton, and McMinnville, and we had some folks representing some individual special districts. So this group pretty much included, I'm sure I've left somebody out, but it included a broad cross-section of the utility farming interests were in, and local government interests were included in this. In addition, we tried to keep other parties that were interested in this in a more peripheral manner involved. This work group managed to come up with the draft you have in front of you. And here's what the draft does do. First, it defines necessary. And if you look at page 1, beginning with bold language on line 14 or line 13, it really begins there. And it defines necessary and says what an applicant for this type of utility facility would have to do. They would have to demonstrate necessity, and to demonstrate it, you do the following things, and it lays it out, which in the manner that we hope is a roadmap for the courts and for county hearings officers on what they are to consider and not to consider in determining necessary. And then they're listed, technical engineering feasibility, it's locationally dependent, and we define that in an effort to keep everybody on the ranch when the session is over. Lack of available urban or non-resource land, availability of existing right-of-ways, in other words, are there right-of-ways you can use, or is there a lack of right-of-ways? Public health and safety, that deals with issues ranging from the obvious to whether you locate pipelines in flatland or hillsides where there might be a slope As you know, there's been pipeline breaks in Washington State because they were located on slopes that had landslide areas, so that's where you could consider those things. And then other requirements of federal and state law, which in other words means if DEQ tells you that's where your outflow must be, well, then that's a factor, obviously, in citing a facility. Then we deal with costs, which is in the next section, page 2, line 6 goes down, and we state in a compromise, we state the costs associated with any of the factors may be considered by the decision maker, but cost alone may not be the sole consideration. So what we're saying there is just because it's cheaper, that doesn't mean you can go on farmland. However, cost is an issue. If there are substantial cost issues, you can consider that, but it can't be the sole issue that you consider when you're, just because the farmland is cheaper doesn't mean that's where the utility can go. We also talk about that land costs shall not be included when considering alternative locations for substantially similar utility facilities. That may seem very esoteric, but that was a very important point for the farm community because it means that when you're comparing similar facilities, that you don't throw the land component in. The land cost is not to be considered as a factor when you're considering similar facilities. That was acceptable to all of us on the utility side because, frankly, utilities go, in our view, where they're needed as opposed to seeking out cheap land. And this is to make clear that we're not involved in a school situation where you had a lot of debate in front of this committee that schools and some other facilities are driven by land costs. And we want to make sure that this process is not driven by land costs.
We were listening well.
We were doing our best, Mr. Chair. We then had one unresolved issue that was really a land use issue, and that's how do you compare dissimilar facilities. And the reason we have punted this in lines 10 through 13 to LCDC, the reason we have done this is because here we're talking about the issue of whether you use the example that was raised in the committee is a treatment facility that uses poplars, let's say, a land application of a sanitary facility versus using a iron and steel in the river application. This gets a little more complicated. Their land is an issue because you might need 200 acres for the poplar or land application, but you might only need 10 acres for the physical plant. And we felt that really gets into land use areas. LCDC has dealt with this issue in their rules in the Goal 11 revisions during the interim. And we felt rather than undo what LCDC had done, we would kick this back to them for them to reexamine that issue to see if there's any guidance needed there on how to do those comparisons. Under line 14 sub C is another critical issue, particularly for the farm community with utilities we're glad to agree to. And that's to make sure that restoring the land as nearly as possible to its former condition is a requirement when you're running utility lines. So this is a pretty straightforward requirement. Sub D on line 22 says that the governing body of the county or its designee shall impose clear and objective conditions on the application to mitigate and minimize the impacts of the proposed facility on the surrounding use. And there again, that was a requirement that the utilities were willing to agree to for the farm community to make sure that we do the least impact that is practicable when we are in that area, and that we do make it clear that you can require mitigation for utility facilities. Then we go on to skip to page 6 of the amendments. And then we add fire facilities and irrigation canals and utility facility service lines as sub 1 uses, okay, that are not subject to the necessity test that we had early. And I want to make that clear on the record. These are additional sub 1 uses, and there's a reason for that. Z is fire service facilities. That's in there because we've had a couple of hearings officers say that the law doesn't allow us to build fire stations to serve rural areas in rural areas. That, of course, was a concept not pleasing to the rural fire districts in the state. So that is a non-controversial provision we put in. Second is irrigation canals. We had a decision, I believe it was in Jackson County, where they said that you couldn't put an irrigation district facility next to an irrigation ditch in a DFU land, because that wasn't a utility. So we have added that for clarification. And then finally, utilities, facility service lines. Now, the reason that is there, we did not want to make people who are hooking up to utilities in rural areas to somehow have to go through this test if these are what we called in the committee de minimis running of lines. In other words, here we're not talking about major transmission lines and major line facilities that need to go through this siting analysis. Here we're talking about local lines that are used to provide service to local areas. And again, in an effort to keep the courts and everybody else clear, we have added a definition of what we mean by utility facility lines. I'm sure at least 25 lawyers in the back of the room are getting nervous about what I have said in some way. At least they're still laughing. They're all here. That, in an overview, is what we attempt the bill to do. We think the bill represents a reasonable balance between the utility's need to be out there in the exclusive farm use zones, both to provide and facilitate services for within the urban area and to provide and facilitate services for the rural or the farm residents. We think it's a good balance. It gives the utilities a roadmap, which the courts and local decision makers will have to follow in what to evaluate to determine necessary and other issues. It gives the farming community some guarantees about mitigation and what will happen after the utility line goes through their area, and it gives them opportunities to also discuss those clear issues, and we think it's a reasonable compromise. What these amendments do, and this is for the record, want to make clear, they define necessary, they require mitigation, they limit use of high-value farmland for wetlands, I forgot to mention that, they add fire facilities, irrigation facilities, and to the sub one list. What they do not do, and this is very important, they do not add any additional requirements or definitions to any other sub one uses that are listed in the statute. This was a concern that legislative council raised. We want to make very clear we're defining necessary. We're talking about mitigation. Those requirements do not apply to any other sub one use on that list. And it applies only to utilities in that section. Counties, therefore, or anyone else, are not allowed to add any additional conditions that would conflict with the Brentmar versus Jackson County decision. And I'd like to say that in the for the record here to make it clear. I think I've said all I can say. Last thing, as in any set of amendments that were done in this manner, I want to, and I really want to thank the chair, and I want to thank Christina, and I want to thank legislative counsel, who bore with. You'll notice these are dash fours, and you haven't seen the other three. That's because we were trying to do the amendments as we agreed to things, so that legislative counsel didn't have, you know, could just add as we went along in these amendments, and also so legislative counsel could see the flow. So there are some things in these dash four amendments that will need addressed on the Senate side. We had a caucus outside and have agreed, all of us, that we will deal with these amendments on the Senate side. And I'll quickly for the record, so there won't be a surprise to the committee, we have a couple of ORs that were left out that need to be in here. I won't bother with you on those. Missing is some language that we had on water rights that was requested by the irrigation districts, and we will be adding that language back in on the Senate side. I believe that was just an oversight that it was left out. It was language we all agreed to. And we have some the section that deals with EFSEC, the Energy Facility Siting Council, and dealing with the interstate transmission line section. There needs to be a we will need to rediscuss that language. And then there are several miscellaneous. Just we had the word crop appears in here, and we'd agreed to take the word crop out. And there's a couple of those small issues. So I just want the committee to know that after the bill hopefully passes the House And while it's on the way to the Senate, which is expecting this bill, the group will meet again and we'll take care of those changes and amend those in the Senate. With that, I hope we have made this reasonably clear.
Any questions in the committee? Yes,
I do. I just have one question. One of the newer things on the landscape are those tall towers that I see located in close to farm buildings. Are those for cell phones?
Probably, I would guess. Maybe some of the utilities people can mention that. If you notice the definition, the current definition of utility facility, talks about purpose of generating power. We added the word electrical to be clear, and then it goes on to say for public use by cellular transmission towers over 200 feet in height. So those electrical towers would still be exempt. Someone else in the audience would have to talk about cell phones. We did talk about cell phones in the committee, and I assume that's probably the towers that you're talking about, and they are locationally required because they have to be in certain areas to give coverage, and we did talk about locational issues. You'll notice that on line 21, double I talks about, on the first page, talks about is locationally dependent, and those kinds of towers would come under that criteria for locationally dependent.
Any more? Other questions?
When you conclude, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask about the wetlands provisions that are scattered through this bill. The requirement that creation or on land other than high-value farmland. There was, I believe, an article yesterday about net loss of wetlands in Oregon and the effort to replace when you eliminate one wetland, you often have to, in order to replace it, you have to create another wetland, and that even now the farmers often don't succeed and are moving them, or maybe you can just go into why this is in this particular bill and the impact on the wetlands replacement policy of the state.
Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau. Mr. Chairman, if I might answer that question, Representative Merkley, the wetlands issue doesn't deal with the quality of the wetland at all. Wetlands are a permitted use now in EFU zones, and our concern was that when they are establishing wetlands, particularly mitigation banking of wetlands, when they're doing that, that be carefully looked at when it's sited on our best farmland so that it can be evaluated for its impact on surrounding farmers and the surrounding farmland where that wetland mitigation bank is going to be established. And so that's the reason it's now put in as a sub-2 use on high-value farmland. If it's on other than high-value farmland, you can go ahead and establish a mitigation bank without any review. But if there's a proposal to establish the bank on high-value farmland, then there needs to be a public review so that, again, the surrounding agricultural people can determine whether or not there's going to be a negative impact on them. And that's what the language is in here for, and that's what it's about. It has nothing to do with the quality of the wetland. And I read the same article in paper this morning, at least not in my paper. I read the article with interest and thought about our bill as it related to that.
If I can clarify that, what you're saying is it isn't necessarily the case that such mitigation would be impossible on EFU that would require public hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question.
I'm trying to restate what you've said and see if I understand it correctly. You're saying that it might still be possible to create wetlands on high-value farmland, but doing so would require a hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, that's correct.
Other questions? I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do others want to give the testimony on this? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher, quickly, I just wanted to put to rest that I'd raise some issues with you on E on page 2, and there are many surprises in land use. This one actually turned out the way we want it, and we will need to amend it on the House side the way the other side wants it, which you will be happy to participate in. I think it was the one that Burton talked to as FSEC. It's actually the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So it works this way, and it will be fixed on the Senate.
Looks like there's some disagreement.
I want their names.
Well, you look right back at him. Yeah. Okay, I think we have somebody in the back. Come forward, please.
My name is Penny Cox. I live at 11140 Worst Corner Road, Rickdale, Oregon. I'm a private citizen, a farmer, and I'm not here representing any group. I'm just here more or less to give testimony about a facility which already exists and how it does impact the private citizens, which of course you people all represent, because you have to represent people in your areas. So there are some real problems that come from this kind of a proposal. It looks, and it is very difficult, and as I have talked to Mr. Schoenberg and Jim Johnson, Department of Ag, the last several weeks, I can understand why it's been in committee and why it is so difficult, because there isn't a forum available yet under Oregon state law which can address all the problems that have to do with municipalities and their problems with their public works and the farmers, so it is very difficult. However, I have some problems with this particular bill because we have been worrying about the word necessary, but we need to make sure there's a definition for facility. And let me give you an example. The city of Dallas has been in need of taking care of some industrial wastewater with their circuit board manufacturer within their city. They needed to get it out of Rickrell Creek and clean it up. DEQ mandated this, so in their final order and stipulation. So what they came up with was a poplar tree, which they referred to, and I'm delighted to hear today, or it's the first time that LCDC is going to go back and look again at 11 under state planning. But let me tell you what the problem was. Without the definition of facility, they were able to say that this was farming, because the poplar trees would be, there was a provision for that in exclusive farmland, and that the circuit board, which had heavy metals and salts and so forth, was beneficial fertilizer. So therefore, they were able to go into farming and bypass the word facility. This is actually part of their wastewater treatment facility program. But you can see that there were some loopholes that they were able to get around in order to do this. And the consequence has been that because it was permitted outright, there was no citizen involvement, there were no public hearings. The commissioners were not given any laws by you people in order to say, well, we have a bill that's been drafted and there have to be public hearings, or at least conditional uses. So I'm hoping several things can happen with this bill, that facilities can be defined better so that when there are public municipalities or states that that need to take care of their utility problems, that there can't be any loopholes for them to be able to come on the prime farmland and buy up. They have lots more money than we do, and they can buy up tremendous amounts of land to put their facilities in close on. Number two, the pollution of the farming. I am glad to hear that in this bill there is provisions made for the destruction of surrounding farmland, because let me tell you what's going to happen here with the Rickrell farmers when the city of Dallas has their poplar trees growing. all the farmers around this area grow grass seed, certified grass seed that's sent around the world. So you can see what the impact is going to be of the poplar trees when they begin to pollute the land in the springtime. Many of you probably have allergies the last few years, which are directly related to the poplar trees, because they're becoming more and more popular. So another thing is that I was hoping there could be some languages in this bill that municipalities, if they are the ones who are putting facilities on prime farmland, that they play by the same rules. This land that they particularly bought had no irrigation rights, but because they're a municipality, they fall under different rules, and they can have irrigation rights where the rest of us can't on our land. So I think they definitely need to have, if they're going to be on prime farmland, and let's look at the same rule playing that all the rest of us have to abide if we're also farming. And I think one of the main things is that there's plenty of language for public input, so that we can't do any more of this through the back door in the middle of the night things between cities and commissioners and so forth, so that they can do this again. We have it before LUBA, and we haven't yet heard their decision, but we need to make sure that there's plenty of language in here to protect the farmers, give the cities what they need. I'm not totally against the cities and municipalities and the states and private companies who need to cross land, but I don't feel that this bill quite yet has it all together that protects the private citizen. We sometimes get involved with committees and people. I would find it curious to see in all the committee meetings that they've had how many private citizens were on the committees that they've had working on this bill. Mainly because we are farmers. We're the ones who are on this prime farmland, and we're farming it, and we know the impact that it's having. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need clarification. Your concern is that you have poplar plantations now in your farm area,
mm-hmm.
and they, in relation to that, have wastewater treatment? Or
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor. What they did was, in order to get rid of this industrial wastewater cheaply, and not build the appropriate facilities necessary to take care of it, like other municipalities have for their circuit board manufacturers. They went ahead and said that this wastewater was beneficial fertilizer. They planted poplar trees, which can absorb a tremendous amount of water, and they have planted them on prime farmland.
Okay, I'm getting it finally. Mm-hmm. It's the circuit board manufacturer who has planted the plantations of the...
No.
I mean, okay.
Mr. Chair, no, the city of Dallas has taken this over completely. They are saying that this circuit board manufacturer is one of their customers, so that's where it's the city of Dallas who has done this. With state lottery.
But I'm still not clear about the situation. You have a circuit board manufacturer. Their wastewater is treated by means of using poplar plantations. No? I'm really lost.
Mr. Chair, it is very complex, and that's why I think I'm here today, is that it gets every situation is so different. Just like this one, it's very unique because DEQ is involved, EPA is involved, and we've got the commissioners involved, and there's so many issues in this, it's just not very simple. The trees are supposed to absorb the water, leaves the heavy metals on the land. The trees do not absorb it, and that's how they are able to clean this water from the circuit board manufacturer so that as it eventually runs back into Rickrell Creek, it's clean. It has left the land with the heavy metals and the salts, but it has gotten clean water back to Rickrell Creek, which was all that the city of Dallas had to do. That was what they were doing. They had to clean up their in Rickrell Creek. So,
excuse me, Mr. Chair, can I just clarify then? So, your concern is that this measure regarding a utility facility and the necessity for it would not be helpful to the city of Dallas in their situation or the county here.
What happened was that under state law and what the county commissioners have in our land use is that if they would have said this was a utility facility, use the word facility, they could never have done it. And let me see why. Because they would have had to have gotten a conditional use, and that would have required public hearings. That would have required notification and all the things that goes under a conditional use application. And so because it was direct farming and they didn't use the word facility, then they were able to just, the city of Dallas has now become farmers. So that's why I urge that there be a strict definition of facility so that they can't say that they're just doing some sort of farming operation.
If I might, Mr. Chair, it would really be a stretch for me to regard a cottonwood plantation as a facility, even if it were being used for the purpose of you know, taking care of a heavy metal situation. If you say that DEQ and EPA are involved, they must have had some concerns addressed there. I don't see how facility comes into play there. Mm-hmm. A facility to me is some sort of structure. The facility of removing heavy metals from the waste of the circuit board manufacturer is being handled by this product, and that's interesting and a little bit scary, I'll admit that. But if we start defining cottonwood plantations as facilities, I've got 11,000 acres of those in my district. You know, we love them. They're planted on marginal farmland, and they're, you know, they're providing fiber for the mills, and so I don't know how we could help that situation with this measure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, this is where it gets very sticky. They are publicly owned treatment works. By definition, the municipality of their operation. By EPA standards and according to CFR, they are doing a treatment, storage, and facility. And instead of it being in iron and steel, they're doing it on fine farmland with poplar trees, which only take up the water. They really don't take up it. So what we have is, what we have is a problem that could be taken care of if there was enough language in the bill for there to be public discussion and advisory committees on these sort of situations so that the people can be alerted to with all the correct information, the public, so that they can get comments on it. And because it's very difficult, we're not talking about just farming poplar trees. There are many poplar trees in Polk County, too, poplar trees. Plantation. But what we're talking about here is using it as a blind to be a publicly owned treatment work with state and federal money. I, as a farmer, can't go into a poplar tree. I couldn't go borrow money from the state lottery to put in a poplar tree plantation. So it gets into where does the funding come from and how much input does the public have into it to be able to have a determination of this proven debt. I'm not saying that in each case it might not happen anyway, but there just needs to be language in the law so that everything is spelled out and there aren't any loopholes.
Mr. Chair.
Anything, Murphy?
Well, you've raised this fairly interesting. It goes under the category often of biofilters, and biofilters are increasingly common. For example, we have one in Portland in the parking lot from the plants industry. I'm not sure that this, when I'm wrestling with this, whether the problem you're raising seems more a problem with the definition of farming than with the definition of utility facility, if I'm hearing you right.
President, Chair, Representative Merkley. I state that your question is problem, is that when you begin to site facilities on farmland, you've got that problem. You've got a problem between necessary facilities on farmland. Where is the line? I must say the EPA in the Region 10 in Seattle has prevented the city of Dallas from beginning to dump any of this effluent on the land because they do feel, number one, it's hazardous waste. Number two, it is a publicly owned treatment works. And so it would be a facility definition under EPA. But then when you go back to the land issue, you've got it's permitted farming. This is very difficult, and I think that there is no forum that there needs to be something because this is not going to be isolated. This is going to be something as municipalities grow and grow. They do have to expand. They are in the strict rules. I sympathize with the city of Dallas in having to clean up their water. I just feel that it could have been done differently had there been public discussion. And it's a matter of communication and being able to have input into it. So I agree with you totally. A land issue, yes. A public works facility, yes. It's strictly. It can't be solved in a land use issue. If LUBA comes back with a decision saying it's not permitted outright on land, if this bill passes, they can come back and say, okay, it's a facility and we're putting it on prime farmland. Or at least they have the opportunity to come back and do that. So we can go back and forth forever. And I didn't mean to narrow this down to our situation. It's the only one that I'm familiar with. I was just hoping to be able to put across that the language of the bill is where the secret lies, mm-hmm. and we wouldn't have this problem.
Mr. Chair, it may be possible that this language ends up helping you in setting out the reasonable alternative language, because whereas before, one without word necessary defined, it could be stretched any which way, but now one would have to show that when considered other reasonable alternatives, such as normal wastewater treatment for your particular problem. So this bill actually may help you with the situation you have, if I'm reading it right. Well, it may not help for ones that have already gone through, prospectively.
Before the city of Dallas did this, coming back to them again as the example, they had determined how many gallons of water a day they had to treat and close. It was absolutely necessary for this technology to take place on prime farmland if this was going to be the acceptable way of treating it. So that thankfully, and I agree with you, I'm for this bill about 80%. I appreciate it, especially the amendments, and I just now had an opportunity to read them, so I'm kind of behind the loop, and I don't know what went on in the committee, but I'm pleased to see that there are there is mitigation. I just wish that there could be a little bit more of definition here of a facility, and that there be. And that would be public hearing somewhere in here. Under the Clean Water Act, for example, and I can't imagine municipalities coming out in prime farmland unless it's going to be under the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air, whatever they need this prime farmland for the utility. They're not going to just go talk to the commissioner and say, well, it's prime farmland and this is necessary technology. They are going to be doing it because they have to take care of clean water. And under that, those laws, there are tremendous amounts of public hearings. They go on, and they're available to the public, advisory committees of the people involved, notification, complete disclosure, state and federal laws. And that's what we have to make sure that we have available in this bill, is that it's usually going to be a land issue, and it is probably going to be another state agency involved, or they wouldn't be out there farming. So if there can just be a recognition that the farming aspects, the commissioners and farm use laws have enough
safeguards in them for public input and enough definition in there, I feel the bill's going to be about 99%. Therefore, for me as a private citizen and as a farmer and as one who has seen the outfall of this in actuality, the representatives in our district, their hands are tied. They cannot help it because there is no language for them to say. And if they have this, I agree that they come back and say, well, did we go through all these lines? It would have been very helpful to have had this. I just feel that there needs to be just a little bit more.
Well, we have an opportunity here. I would like to move this bill on to the Senate. We have a chance to work with the group, I'm sure. And you probably, you know, it behooves you to do that. No problem. Representative GNL.
Mr. Chairman, I just, Representative Taylor asked most of my questions. I just had one little short one that was about the allergies from the poplar tree. Are there allergies from the grass seed to the poplar tree seem to be worse?
Okay, well, depends, you know, I just was probably being a little glib when I said about poplar trees. Just to emphasize the fact that they are becoming more and more popular, not only for fiber, which is good because we need them for our paper, but they are a crop that can have direct detriment on surrounding crops. Whereas alfalfa isn't going to, an alfalfa crop necessarily isn't going to affect grass seed, certified grass seed crop.
I'm just curious.
Well, the poplar trees in the spring, they have all of the cotton, and it gets into the harvest, the grassy fields and cells. So it's hard to clean up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's very expensive.
The poplars out in my area are harvested before they produce anything like that. Are these the hybrid cottonwoods we're talking about? Fast growing within 8 years of harvested or something like that?
They are experimenting with about 8 different kinds of poplar trees on this farm.
Mm-hmm.
So they have said that they're hybrids. And not to be at all disrespectful to any of you here, I don't feel that the poplar tree was necessarily the issue. That's the one that I know about and I'm aware of. It could have been something else. They could have had willow trees that they planted. I just use the example here that because there was no public input, because they did it under strict farm rules, there was no discussion of poplar trees. Under the Clean Water Act and under RCRA rules, there are advisory committees that are made up of the farmers, and there could have been some compromises made if this is indeed what the City of Dallas is allowed to do, of perhaps a different crop. There are some wonderful brassicaceae grasses that could have absorbed all of this water also. So there was a lot of other fauna and flora that they could have planted had there been some other input from people in the area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move the Dash 4 Amendment to House Bill 2865.
Representative Cruz moves Dash 4 Amendment to House Bill 2865. Any further discussion? Okay. Any opposition? So moved.
Mr. Chairman,
this is approved.
I move the House Bill 2865 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2865 amended with the Dash 4 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Representative support.
I just hope that I think you've recognized this, that this bill still has things to work on the Senate side, and that some of the comments that were made by a private citizen, I'm sorry, I forgot what her name was, will be addressed on the Senate side.
The chair will certainly expect those things that our participants here have been talking about, further work needs to be done. And knowing this, Lou, I know this last two sessions we had this discussion too, and it's been before us, and I think we're closer than we've ever been. And I don't want to see a meltdown here, and I really, really hope that we can get something out this session and move forward, because it would be very positive if we do that. So I certainly will be watching it closely, and I do have a good relationship and connection with our counterpart over there on the Senate side. So I know that there will be continued work. So I appreciate that.
So, clerk, please call them out.
Aye.
Yes.
Excuse. Mrs. Deborah? Excuse. Mrs. Gaynella? Aye. Mrs. McCoy? Aye. Mrs. Merkley? Excuse. Mrs.
Morgan?
Aye.
Mrs. Taylor?
Aye.
Chair Wolf?
Aye.
And required number of votes, House Bill 2065 as amended, passed the floor with the due pass recommendation, and the carrier. Well, I think we have the Representative Lewis is on the bill, right? As the chief prompted. We could certainly check with her to see if she'd like to hear it.
Do you even know what it's turned into?
What does she know? I doubt it.
Ms. Chair.
She is in a district, really, that she comes from. So
this is Sheriff.
I appreciate if somebody from that in the farming community and district and everything else and close to urban growth and so what they need. To carry it. So we'll check with her. And if not,
my chair will carry.
Okay. We'll close our work session. That's at 2865. Okay.
One chair's off. I should have done that sooner because I didn't want to see this.
Let's take a look at that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Open a hearing on health, Senate Bill 964. Ray, would you like to come forward?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ray Thompson. I'm here representing Metro. For the past several years, Metro's had a problem with the disposal of small chemical that deals with pool chlorine. And it has been a difficulty for the organization for a number of years. In fact, in one instance, an employee was very seriously injured, spent 3 days in the hospital, burned lungs or skin. And for quite a while, we have been having this sort of pool chlorine release. That is where the pool chlorine crystals mix with any kind of wet substance, they create a cloud. And it's not clear what it is. You have to call hazmat and do all sorts of things to do that. And we have these on an average about once a month. So we've been working on an approach. Our initial approach was to deal with it in a fashion that probably was not acceptable. What we did is we worked through with Senate side a set of amendments that does address and meet the concerns of all of the parties involved in the disposal of solid waste in the metro region. Essentially, what we want to be able to do is control the disposal of pool chlorine in such manners to ensure the protection of public and solid waste workers within Metro's jurisdiction. The EQ's concerns related to illegal dumping in rural areas where disposal of pool chlorine is less convenient than the metro area. The regulation of the disposal of pool chlorine will not be a problem within Metro's jurisdiction since the agency has disposal facilities conveniently located for such disposal. And the people disposing of pool chlorine are accountable under this legislation, not the haulers or the operators of disposal facilities. Metro intends to initiate an aggressive education program to ensure that the agency is proactive with the people and companies disposing of pool chlorine. Basically, it's the lodging industry, and we've talked to them, and they're very supportive of this, and they're going to be very active in our helping solve this problem. The emphasis in this matter by Metro will be to stop the casual disposal of pool chlorine not to make it difficult or expensive for someone to properly dispose of unneeded pool corn. There was no opposition to this measure in the Senate. I've worked through most of the issues. In fact, I worked through all of the issues with the interested parties, and it passed the Senate with a vote of 28-0. I want to thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer your questions, and I would encourage the committee to move this bill maybe today.
Really, I think to begin with, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think there's having a pool and dealing with chlorine, I read the instructions.
Yes, sir.
And I think there's, I'm not sure the necessity of the bill. And I know that a little education goes 100 miles in this city. And I'm not sure why we can't work that out.
Well, Mr. Chair, in response, in working through this, the Secretary General Counsel and the other and the attorneys that were working with DEQ felt that this was the best way to handle this sort of situation. What we're trying to do is create an educational program and create mechanisms for doing that. What we do discover every now and then, though, is that the pool owners will oftentimes thoughtlessly dispose of it, and more importantly, we have instances where people will buy a business that has been closed, and this may be on the shelf. What we want to be able to do is have the opportunity to create a proactive educational program. And the DQ and Metro worked on it, and they thought this was the best solution for that purpose.
Mr. Chairman,
I was just wondering if you could give me an example. You're talking about the pool chlorine that's in containers, and you're talking about the chlorine that's in the swimming pool.
No, ma'am, in containers. It's the crystal pool chlorine. There'd be small portions left over. And what happens is we have transfer stations, and the material is dumped into these pits, and then it's pushed. You make a 20-ton slug of material, and you make two of those for every one trailer that Metro uses to take its solid waste to Arlington, which is the location of their landfill. What occurs is when you have this crystalline make contact with the with any kind of a moisture, you get a release. In one instance, we had a driver who was in the van waiting to pull the trailer away. The fumes just came right in on him and darn near killed him. And what we want to be able to do is create a process that would make it safer for those people, plus the fact that an awful lot of the general public and Metro use transfer stations, what we call self-haul, and they're in the facility when these releases occur as well, and so there is a problem for them as well. And we thought that it would be a good opportunity, and we worked with DEQ, and we thought it would be a good opportunity to take this approach so that we can try to make it safer for our employees as well as the people in the general public.
Well, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Could you give me an example of what you have in mind for safety?
Well, the Metro working with DEQ and others would have to create the regulations, and it would be hard for me to forecast, but what I believe will be one of the products after talking to the lodging industry people is that we would have an ongoing educational program with people who clean pools and or maintain pools at the various hotels and motels in the metropolitan area. Also, Metro has many an opportunity for what they call Has Waste Day, where people can bring at very nominal cost all of the different kinds of hazardous waste or other kinds of waste, such as paint and other kinds of things. They can bring these to special areas. We would reinforce and make more specific pool chlorine as one of those things that ought to be brought to these kinds of facilities. Those are two examples that I can think of.
One more?
Yes.
At the moment, you don't have it listed as a hazardous waste right now?
No, ma'am, we do not.
Thank you.
Or no, we don't want to treat it that way. We initially started off treating it that way, but that gets pretty complicated when you get out into the rest of Oregon. To treat the material that way. It's far more expensive to handle, and it creates other kinds of problems with regard to disposal. And our view is, and it was shared with DHQ, since it's our problem, and DHQ and Metro have worked out this solution.
Mr. Chair. I was confused why we needed to add permissive language to the statute until I read sub 1 of section 1, and then I see why we have to, but I'm a little confused as to how this gets you to education.
Well, it creates the opportunity for Metro to establish by ordinance or rule those educational opportunities, Representative Cruz, and that will be the process by which we will be more specific in our education.
Well, not really. Do you have a guess as to where you're going to go with the rules, or we're still too front end for that?
I still think that's the front end. I mean, everybody who has an interest is already aware that this is a possibility, and they've all been invited. The pulp and paper people have, the chlorine chemistry people have. The idea is to work at this so that it's safe for the public and the employees.
My point was that the Metro and everyone involved should be able to do that without legislation.
Well, Mr. Chair, apparently not, because when we initially set out to do this, we tried to regulate the pool chlorine disposal itself, mm-hmm. and that really caused a great deal of difficulty. And that's when Metro and the DEQ sat down and came to this conclusion, or this solution, as to how best to accomplish what Metro needs to do in order to create this program. I kind of share your viewpoint, but the fact of the matter is the folks that regulate this and the folks that have to administer it have all agreed this is the solution.
Well, I know that we send wherever possible in our industry, we deal with quite a few chemicals, and I've certainly gone to school for all of it to be, you know, as a material handler. Mm-hmm. And certainly when you deal with herbicides and pesticides, you have to. I guess I don't understand why that's not part of the ongoing program, especially in something that is volatile like chlorine. Because if you don't handle that substance correctly, you can really, there's no doubt about it.
Well, as a matter of fact, we have one employee with that.
I just think it boils down to, the responsibility of those people who are handling that to make sure that those who are reading labels certainly understand that, and whenever there's education is offered, that should be out there, that they're in attendance. I think we should have other statutes that guide us in that and rules. I know. Is it just...
Well, this is what I was told was the solution that was worked out between the regulator and the administrator, and it seems that we need this in order to be able to do as you're talking, or as you're describing.
President Morgan.
I'm curious, because I believe you said that Portland now has a program where people can bring in used paint and household chemicals and things like that. And that isn't governed by this statute here?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, no.
Then I guess my question is, why wouldn't the disposal of excess pool chlorine be able to be included in that statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, to my knowledge, what is called for in this statute is this proposal is the way to get there. As determined by DEQ and Metro. I agree with you, but it was determined by DEQ and by Metro, the regulator and the administrator, that in order for Metro to do this, we need the statute. That's our change in order to do it.
And there's nobody here from DEQ right now?
No.
The part about the education also, I don't get in here where you're going to be able to educate people.
Thank you. Well, that would be part of the development of the ordinance for the purposes of outreach. And I've given you a couple of examples, and I'm sure there's going to be more. The objective here is to educate and to encourage people to the fullest extent possible not to casually throw it away. And there's going to be, I'm sure, many different ways to accomplish that. I was giving you just a few.
Okay. I'm assuming that you'd adopt rules as for proper disposal, and you'd make sure that the people at pool have got copies of those rules so they'd know the way that they're supposed to dispose of it, and that would be how they're educated.
Yeah.
Just a guess.
Well, I... this is a very serious problem.
It is. It can be. Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else?
No.
Anyone else want to get testimony on this? Okay. So hold off until Friday. Close the work session on Senate Bill 964. Open a hearing on Senate Bill 1184. John Chandler and Dave Honeycutt again. Oh, we lost Chandler. So.
We need to find. See, there he is.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. I didn't check them off. Pretty short,
Bill. Go ahead, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Director of Criminal Affairs of the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 1184. This bill tweaks the state moratorium statute to close a loophole that has developed. If you look at the current language of the law on pages on lines 10 through 12, this is where the statute says what a moratorium is not. A moratorium is a stoppage or slowdown of issuance of building permits. So as a general rule, if you're stopping permits, slowing them down, that's a moratorium. The statute says there are circumstances where it isn't a moratorium, and this is one of them. The current law says does not include denial or delay of permits or authorizations because they're inconsistent with applicable statutes, rules, zoning, or other laws or ordinances. That language is put in the moratorium law initially to prevent somebody who comes in with and say, I want to build a house in a commercial zone, they won't let me, therefore that's a moratorium. That's the kind of situation you're trying to address. What has happened over time is that as jurisdictions struggle with the development of infrastructure, they don't have enough money, they have a hard time putting plans in place. A lot of times they're reluctant to declare a moratorium because that can have a perceived negative impact upon their economic development potential. So what they have been doing is denying, say there's not enough road capacity. Instead of denying based on a lack of road capacity, which would require them to declare a moratorium, they're denying based on the fact that their local ordinance says you have to have enough road capacity for the project to go forward, and so they're denying it on the basis that it violates their ordinance. It's a loophole, pure and simple, and we understand why jurisdictions do that. Most times it's not done maliciously. It's simply done because they would rather not declare the moratorium. From our standpoint, even though we do not like moratoriums as a general rule, the moratorium statute has a procedure in it that requires the local government, once they declare the moratorium, to set about fixing it. And what we find now with this kind of rolling non-moratorium, they can slow down permits, they can stop permits, but they don't have to go fix it. And what this bill will do, I hope, we tried to fix this in 95, it didn't take apparently. What we're trying to do with this bill is say, if it's a shortage of public facilities that you're up against, then declare the moratorium. Or issue the permit, one or the other. But if you don't have enough road capacity, don't have enough water, don't have enough sewer, whatever it might be, the proper thing for the government to do is declare the moratorium, stop issuing permits, and then we go about the assessment process of trying to figure out what the solution is. We believe this bill closes a loophole that's going to be used more often than it should be. It came out of the Senate, I think, unopposed. People who needed to care about the bill signed off on it in the Senate committee, and we would encourage you to move it along.
Do you have any opposition?
None that I was aware of, Mr. Chairman.
It's one of those things that can help the process. I was very closely related to a moratorium in our own small town in Veneta. We had proposed Bill Due, 750 housing sites. Pay for a building industry, but boy, our facilities, treatment and water would not handle it. And so they used a moratorium to take care of that issue, but went about. They got grants and everything else and are moving rapidly towards taking care of the problem. Start opening it up. And they can at any point in time when they see that those streets have started putting streets in and everything else and meet about the time that they've finished.
Right.
With the new facilities there are rebuilt and designed. So,
Chair Welsh, members of the committee, Dave, I think that my experience with moratorium and the reason that I'm talking on or support this bill was the fact that that local governments, I've been involved in cases where local governments have actually denied permits because my folks would not voluntarily give some of their property for a street improvement. And so since the local government knew they couldn't condition approval on the street improvements because it would violate Dolan, would violate the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Dolan, they said to my folks, well, if you want to voluntarily make the street improvement or give us the property and then come back with an application and approve it, we'll deny it. Well, in a sense that essentially what they're doing is declaring a moratorium without declaring a moratorium. So this bill will fix that.
Good. That's improved.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support this bill. I just am a little uneasy when the explanation is longer than the bill. Or not.
He's been waiting all session.
Yes. Good bill to pass.
Yeah. And I need to open in a work session. Let's check with you, Wrestling Mercury, a moment to take a look at this. Ask any questions if he has any.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jamal.
Would you just repeat? You said this will fix declaring a moratorium. A moratorium, or what was it? What was your wording there? I was writing that down.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but what we're trying to address is what I call a non-moratorium moratorium. The moratorium is when you stop issuing building permits. Legally, a moratorium only exists when the local government says, okie doke, we have a moratorium. But from our standpoint, the effect is the same, whether they said, okie doke, we have a moratorium and declare it, or they just simply stop issuing permits. And that effect on the ground is identical. It means that we can't go forward with a project that otherwise is allowed. So what we're trying to get to is to tell the both governments with this bill, if you have a shortage of facilities, the right thing to do is not to stop issuing permits without declaring a moratorium. The right thing to do is declare the moratorium. Because once you've done that, and it's language that isn't in the bill in front of you, it's current law that we're not changing, there is a statutory process that gives them I won't bore with all the chickens, 6 months to fix the problem. They can roll that for a total of 24 months. So if they need to go find some more money or do some planning or it's just the time within which they do that. And then currently the situation we're running into with jurisdictions that are using this non-moratorium approach is there is no such deadline. There's no plan that has to be put into place to fix the problem.
No process.
Follow up, Mr.
Chair?
Yes. Since you know.
In that way, you know what you're dealing with time-wise, on a timeline.
That's exactly right, Representative.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Did we have clarification of what happened on the Senate side with this bill?
Mr. Chair, members, it was 30-0.
I look in front of
you. It was a big 4-5, so.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chandler, where is this? Has this been a problem in a particular jurisdiction, or is it a sporadic problem around the state?
Mr. Governor Murphy, it's been a problem in several jurisdictions, the most notable right now, the Clackamas County, which has a real dearth of road money. And I said, it's one of the things I said at the outset that you weren't in the room for, that the jurisdictions that are trying to end run the moratorium statute are not doing so to be malicious. They're trying to maintain business as usual at the extent they can. In Clackamas County, Metro has designated a lot of that area to get the, where the Riverwalk Boundary will expand when the courts get done fiddling with it. There's going to be a lot of growth out there, and they have had their throats cut by the ONC money and other things, so they have no money to work with. They've threatened to declare a moratorium, and in the process of asking things that they shouldn't ask for, suggested FCC increases that probably may or may not be appropriate. And we're not aiming this bill at Clackamas County at all, because there are other jurisdictions doing this, but to answer your question, our preference would be, frankly, for them to drop the hammer, declare the moratorium. I think politically and financially, they'd be better off, we'd be better off, because it would force the issue then. Right now, it's almost on a site-by-site basis as each project comes through, and that's not a good way to do business. We've had similar problems with other jurisdictions, particularly those experiencing fast growth. The moratorium statute was designed to be the escape valve for a planning system, in a sense, that you're supposed to plan your way into the future. But for those circumstances where you're simply overwhelmed by events, whether it be, you know, more growth than you expected, or whether it be a water main blowing out, or there is a process in law to give jurisdictions a little bit of a breather. We simply believe that they should use that process because of the requirements fixed within the state of the state law.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chandler, on the where there was greater testimony on the Senate side, did the cities and feel that they could live with this language? Did they have any great protests about it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the cities and counties were fine with it.
I don't think there was any testimony on the other side.
We talked about it out in the hallway, walking through the situation we're trying to address. In 1995, we passed a law that primarily being the city of Wilsonville, which was having a problem at that point. Much the same set of actions. They were trying to avoid a moratorium, even though they had a problem with water and roads on the south end of town. And this is simply, I think, the next step in the process of focusing attention at the local level on the need to call things what they are. And if you're out of facilities, the right thing to do is not to slow projects down, like Mr. Honeycutt said, half this stuff you're not entitled to get otherwise. The right thing to do is to call it, stop the process, and then that certainly gets our attention. We would help fix it, gets the legislature's attention, and then it raises the issue then to a higher level locally.
And the situations are resolved without an individual application being caught up in the process, which is where I'm supposed to come.
Can a moratorium be something short of the entire city? Can it be? In other words, we have a problem in this sector where we don't have the infrastructure, so on and so forth.
Mr. Chairman, I remember, yes, they can be very site-specific, and I won't bore you with all the pictures again, but there's two different types of moratorium, both of which, one would be respond to acts of God, the other would be to respond to planning failures, basically. But both can be site-specific. There's also a procedure in Oregon law called the public facility strategy where a jurisdiction can adopt, which is not quite a moratorium. It says, look, we anticipate a whole bunch of growth. We think it's going to go here. We don't think we have the water capacity or sewer capacity. So in advance of that, we're going to start timing permits or, you know, some other way of phasing things out so that you can address a specific part of town or a specific block if that's the only place there's a problem. In fact, the statute specifically says that the moratorium has to be limited in scope, the least intrusion in the industry, basically. So he would play heck doing a citywide moratorium if they didn't have a citywide problem.
Yeah. When I first glanced at this, I was thinking of a project I did where the street was not in, and the street had to be figured out through a local improvement district before we could go ahead. And the city just basically said, well, that was our problem to figure out the LID and figure it out, great, otherwise not. And I don't know if that would come into play with this sort of here where it says, including inadequate facilities.
Mr. Representative Merkley, it probably could have before this bill, but jurisdictions don't declare moratoriums lightly. There's only been a handful in Oregon. And most of those are, and I can't think of a single one because it wasn't a legitimate response to a facilities crisis. The need to go past an LID, again, the statute has, and we helped write it years ago, the statute has a very strict set of findings both everyone has to adopt. And for the most part, the system has worked very, very well. And we're, again, this is not an attack on the local governments. We're just trying to make things work better by clarifying what you're doing at those facilities.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 1184, the first due process recommendation.
I'll make sure. Make sure we're in a work session on Senate Bill 1184.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1184 to support the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves Senate Bill 1184 to support the DPAS recommendation. Further discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Hearing required from the vote. Senate Bill 1184 passed the floor with due pass recommendation. Senate Bill 1184A passed the floor with the due pass recommendation. Okay, I'd like to suspend the rules and allow Representative Merkley to vote on House Bill 2865. To record his vote, please. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We need one more. Okay. Well, Cherry, Bill 1184. Anybody here would like to carry that? What's the name of the person who would like to carry that? No, we need one more.
Well, Julie, it's our chance to make a break for it. Well, she's not.
Don't make me be a bad person.
Is this our last bill? One more.
The motion before us provided by the chair to suspend the rules allow Representative Merkley to record his vote on House Bill 2865. And we are in I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2865. Let's see.
Very good.
Okay. Thank you very much. We close the session on House Bill 2865. Thank you very much. And we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 835. We're just going to have a hearing on...
How about
838? 838, yeah. We'll open a work session on... hearing on 838A. Is there anyone to give testimony?
Jim Lockwood.
And Jim Lockwood. All I have recorded to give testimony on Senate Bill 838.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Greg Dawson. I'm here representing Metro.
Metro requested this legislation to be more effective and efficient in meeting stewardship responsibilities and administering the agency's open space parks and streams program. This program is based on acquiring land from willing sellers and has been very successful. To date, Metro has purchased 4,000 acres and dedicated it to open space. The Open Space Parks and Streams program is funded by a $135.6 million bond measure approved in 1995 by 62% of the voters living in the Metro region. Many landowners have indicated to Metro that they would desire to see their land preserved for the benefit of future generations of Oregonians, but they are not ready to sell their homes. This legislation will give landowners the needed rights and flexibility to achieve public benefits. This legislation will allow lot line adjustments so landowners can retain existing residences while selling surrounding acreage to Metro for permanent open space and natural habitat protection. Keep existing houses in natural areas in private ownership and enjoyment, thus not unnecessarily taking houses out of the market and off the property tax rolls. Save taxpayer funds by not having to purchase such residences. Allow for effective park development to meet Oregonians' growing demand for safe, accessible park facilities. Attached to my testimony are three exhibits which I'd like to share with you to demonstrate our legislation. Exhibit A, this particular one here, this is a property adjacent to Forest Park in Multnomah County. Because we didn't have this legislation and this was a willing sale, Metro, although the homeowner would like to have kept their home, Metro did purchase this property, including the house. The house cost $300,000. If we had this legislation, Metro would not have had to spend public money of $300,000. The second exhibit is one that's in, that was in Multnomah County. The second exhibit is in Washington County. It's a tract of land on Highway 99E. Metro has purchased the land from 99E to the Tualatin River. The area that we are very interested in is about midway in this picture, midway of the track to the Tualatin River. The upper portion we purchased, but we actually, we do not need it, but it came as buy it all or you get none. The Tualatin Park and Recreation District would like to use the upper portion, that part toward 99E, to create a recreational opportunity for the people that live there. Under the present circumstances, we cannot divide that land and allow that to happen. The third illustration is in Clackamas County, and that is a tract of land we purchased from a resident who really is an older person who really wants to stay on this site because it's just where she's spent a great deal of her life. However, given the negotiations, she willingly sold the property. She would much rather have stayed there. We would much rather have had her stay there. But we could not, according to the legislation in effect today. We would be able to carve out her residence, and then she could stay there, and it stays on the tax rolls, and it remains hers. There is no opposition to this legislation, and it passed Senate 26-0. I ask the committee to move this legislation along. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Ray. Any questions? And we have other testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Lockwood, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. We are supportive of Senate Bill 838, and we're, I guess you'd say, kind of apologetic and sorry that when the final language came out, we realized that there was one inadvertent piece of wording in it that kind of steps on a current practice in parks. And so we've been talking in the back with DLCD and with Mr. Phelps and others and out in the hallway to kind of come up with a conceptual amendment to add one little phrase to line 22 on page 2, and
can I get you to
actually a couple? Thank you. With me is Nan Evans, our policy and planning chief, just in case there are any questions. She knows about how some of this affects us, but what it really is on that line 22 of page 2, where it says is not eligible for siting a dwelling, the State Parks and Recreation is requesting that an additional phrase be added there, except as allowed under ORS 195.120. And that's under the current law developed last session. And what we're trying to do is support the bill, but we're trying to step in here and keep it from obliterating something that we have operational right now in a similar situation.
What was that citation again?
ORS 195.120. And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's all unless there are any other questions that Nan or I or Ray can answer for you.
Questions?
There's no opposition to this?
No.
Guys and friends like it?
They're not opposed. I won't go so far as to say they like it. No one opposed it. We worked through with the OCD and the Parks and Farm Bureau and others, and everybody signed off. I honestly don't believe I talked to the housing firm.
Comment, Mr. Chair, it's odd to me that we looked at a bill to cite schools in the same situation, and there was a lot of opposition to it.
I know. We got double standards within our department and within those who advocate for the department.
Well, in
competition development. And now we hear some thousand friends. And we've worked hard on a number of different bills, and you'll have to get past the chair who philosophically had a real problem if we can't cite for the reasons that that we were head of the bills, schools, churches, fire department, all those things that came before here, before us, and then we allow Metro to do the same thing after, or almost.
Mr. Chair, this is different. We're buying a piece of land that already has a home on it, and what we want to be able to do is divide the home and take the home away from the land so we can keep all of the open space available for Argonians for a long, long time, and let the homeowner maintain the home. We're not looking to site any kind of property on open space land. What we're simply trying to do is to use our meager resources to purchase more open space land. So we're not siting anything on that land.
That's fine. I understand that. But the second issue with me philosophically, I have a problem with the government buying more land. I'd much rather see it in private hands than on tax rolls. That's one of my philosophical idiosyncrasies.
What is the intent of the use of the land? I mean, I heard parks and different things like that. So you're taking this land out of agricultural usage?
It's not really now in agricultural usage. It's just more or less standing idle. And it's been sort of growing up. Well, we have a program at Metro where we try to preserve the Tualatin River. We try to preserve other kinds of open space opportunities that can be used for conservation and other things. Our voters approved the bond measure, and they did by a pretty hefty majority. And what we're trying to do is carve off a piece and try not to spend $300,000 for a house that we're going to tear down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a terrible waste of money. We don't want the house. And so we're going to tear it down. Rather than leave that portion of it on the tax rolls and have it still in the residential inventory, or create an opportunity for a park and rec district to develop recreational opportunities in some parts of the region where we buy land, where we don't want it all, but we have to buy it all because it's an all or nothing sale. And then if there's an identified need that can be used for recreational purposes, just like Spalding Park and Rec, which could be ball fields or just family outing opportunities, whatever the case may be, you would have that opportunity. And then you have other instances where some people have a homestead and they want to kind of preserve the homestead, but they want to be able to preserve the rest of it for Argonians for in perpetuity. The land will be used as a natural resource area and a conservation opportunity for people who live in the area. And that's why 62% of the voters approved.
What's the land zoned?
Farm.
So ESU?
Yes, or forest, whichever.
Yeah.
That's not true.
How far outside the urban growth boundary are we talking about here?
It's all inside.
It's all inside the urban growth boundary.
Yes, sir.
So when development gets out there, then you are the owner.
This is already inside the urban growth.
I know that. But you aren't instant. So how what kind of assurance is it at some point this just isn't developed when everything around it becomes developed?
Well, that's the part of the bond measure requires that land be maintained in perpetuity for the conservation natural resource benefit, and also to protect the banks of the Tualatin wherever we can, and other kinds of environmental uses as well as conservation uses.
But realistically, as development moves around this parcel, I mean, it's not just going to stay an empty field. It is going to become a park or, ball fields or something, one would assume, wouldn't you?
Well, in some of the natural areas, it'll remain just that.
Well, yeah.
But the one exhibit, Exhibit B, is one where you would actually get into people. Use where you really have ball fields or barbecue or whatever other kinds of things you have in a public park. Those are becoming scarce in a highly metropolitan area. And this is an opportunity to save that kind of land. We've now purchased from those proceeds about 4,000 acres. And that's what our voters would like to see. And the present status of it is we would be buying this land anyway. It would then go out of the tax roll. And the house would come down. So we'd spend $300,000 to tear down a house.
Yeah, no, I understand. Well, more aptly, I guess, this real similar situation with the forest land here. And we had a special bill that they provided amendments to. We wanted to carve out that 5 acres, 4 acres or so, that the house without destroying the house, and allow the continued use of high-value forest land on the rest of it, you know. And we want to be able to do that. Awesome.
I guess there's things I need to know, or need to learn yet. I guess I was assuming that once land gets into the inside the urban growth boundary, it doesn't stay ESU land for a long period of time. I mean, obviously, the 20-year bill will surprise, you know, it could be up to there, but we assume that the encroachment will happen, and so the ESU, there's a zoning change that happens at some point in the process.
No, the zoning change would have to occur parcel by parcel. This land will not change from being set aside for conservation and natural resource and other kinds of environmental benefits. The land won't change.
So what will it be zoned?
It will probably remain as either exclusive farm or exclusive forest. Yes, you?
And the park is an acceptable practice on ESU land?
Not in Washington County. They do not have a process to accomplish that. Each one of those counties is different.
What says you know?
Mr. Chairman, just wanted to check. Did you say that's 4,000 acres?
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you show me where in here it says inside the urban growth boundary? Where is that in here?
I don't know. The first one, the urban growth boundary, is up here.
No, in the bill.
Oh. I don't know. It doesn't say that inside the urban growth boundary.
In the bill? So this can be anywhere?
Well, yeah.
Huh?
As long as it's, as long as it's part of the program of Metro to protect those natural resources.
Hmm.
What may be more productive, Mr. Chair, is if we were to, I understand you're going to reschedule the other bill. It might be productive if I bring the Metro people down here and they could go through it in more detail than I'm doing.
That would be fine, too.
Yeah, and I'm sure that if we have lots of members in the committee here, there will be more questions.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Interested in it too. Okay. Any other questions? Not? Anyone else want to get that one? Claire?
Involved members of the committee and Blair Batson, Thousand Friends, and she gave us the opportunity. I think the points that were made by Representative Cruz and I think Representative Morgan made it's right what you're observing. This is non-farm use being allowed in ESU zones. And I think the issues of whether you want to have a particular process to divide it off are the same. I mean, a public park is allowed in the ESU zone. I would disagree with with Mr. Phelps. The way we read the bill, this does affect lands in ESU zones outside urban growth boundaries. It did not limit it inside of urban growth boundaries. That may have been the intention, but that's not what it's doing. And the reality is Metro is buying up a lot of parkland down the ESU zones. So your observation is that it's no different than creating a special provision for dividing off a parcel for a church or school is the same. So we're not supportive of that effort. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Blair. I appreciate that. All right. Okay. Having no further business, we'll close hearing on Senate Bill 838, and we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you.